soft skills as part of job labor and economic recovery, finance, economic development, as well as identifying and establishing research chairs. So I think that's the end of it, Honorable Mkhatshwa, Honorable Members. I know you had set up to 5 to 10, so I've saved about 10 minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dichi. We'll now move on to the presentation by DHET. Ms. Gatsa, if you can take over. Oh, you said as well, Ms. Dambalo. Sorry, Ms. Dambalo, you can take over. There's a bit of a bias towards Amakhosikazi. It was solid.
The first day passed the Women's Month, Honorable Chair.
So that's why we... Women's Month every day.
Can I also check, Honorable Members, do you see my presentation?
We can see it.
Okay, that's good. I just want to have it in a slight mode. Okay. Thanks very much, DG. Very good morning, honorable members and colleagues from the department, as well as the DSI. Our presentation basically is going to be dealing with the part of our post-school education and training interventions that we do have in place with regard to economic reconstruction and recovery plan. You'll see, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, that we'll be covering these areas, background, approach and principles of the skill strategy, dimensions. We have two dimensions that we'll be going through, progress with regard to the implementation of the strategy, and then obviously we're looking into all areas of the post-school education and training. This is a brief introduction, Honorable Chair. The government, as you know, has developed the Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Plan, which was launched in October 2020 as part of course of response to COVID-19 global health pandemic. The extent of these challenges has been recognized by social partners, especially at NetLeg, where we are also busy engaging on the skills strategy. You'll see that there is a strong commitment to mobilize all our resources and efforts in economic activities that will put the economy in a sustainable trajectory. We have identified below some of the very important interventions, about 7 of them, that we are ensuring that there are skills that are available so that there is no constraint in each and every priority intervention. The very first one there, infrastructure investment and delivery, industrialization through localization, energy security, support for the recovery and growth of the tourism, creative and cultural industries. Well, honorable members will know quite very well that that sector, tourism, creative and cultural industries was one of the sectors which was worstly affected by COVID-19. And also the records of the state SA showed that there has been a huge decrease, I should think about 71% of traveling, especially from outside to the country, and tourism also in excess of 70%. So it tells us then, therefore, that is one of those sectors of the economy that we really need to pay a particular attention. Green economy interventions, agriculture and food security, mass public employment, including the presidential youth employment intervention. DG has also alluded with regard to some of the work that we are doing in this area. And then we have just received about 190 million from National Treasury. We'll be rolling out very soon some of the interventions, especially regarding to demand-led skills training, as well as a graduate assistant in our universities. So the difference with this approach, if we compare to any other approaches, is that this one is demand-led. Because if you are going to respond to these priority interventions of the Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Plan, we must be demand-led. So therefore, you'll see later in some of the slides whereby we'll be showing some occupational shortages as well as the skills gaps which we have identified associated with the ERRPs. Short to long term, the emphasis that we are placing here is that the strategy is intended to respond immediately to skills-related imperatives of the ERRPs, while simultaneously ensuring that the post-school education and training system builds skills that are required in the medium to long term. Especially if you see, for example, in our university sector, you're looking into critical skills that are required that we are currently engaged with the finalization of that list. A target group, in the main, you know quite very well, Honorable and Honorable Members, that the challenge of youth unemployment in the country, which is standing currently at 64.4%, as well as young people who are not in employment, education and training standing somewhere at 3.3 million. Those are huge numbers. So then that is why then therefore the strategy itself is focusing in young people as well as existing employees. Because, Honorable Members, you'll be aware that if we look into quarter one of 2020 and quarter two of 2020, we lost about 2.2 million jobs. And then we are in a recovery path, if one were to say, because we had about 16.4 million jobs in quarter one of 2020. And now in quarter two of 2021, we're still somewhere at 15 million. And then if you look, deficit there is quite very huge, 16.4 to 15 million at more or less 1.4 million. Obviously, in the quarter one of 2021 to quarter two of 2021, we lost about 54 jobs. So then, therefore, that is why there is a focus, amongst others, in skilling and reskilling of the current workforce, so that we are not going back, especially to quarter two of 2020. Better coordination, and I must say, we have learned some lessons with regard to COVID-19 in terms of coordinating our responses, especially as government, as well, of course, with our social partners. Public-private partnerships are always very important, especially if we look into the interventions that we are implementing as the post-school education and training system, because I was at some point looking into the work that we're producing in terms of artisans. You'll find that more than 60% of the artisans that we produced as the country, we do produce them in the private sector. So we need to continue strengthening this kind of a partnership between public and private. So this is emphasized in the strategy. So balancing between short and long term, as I've alluded earlier on, is quite very critical if we are going to ensure a sustainable post-school education and training system. So importantly, because if you are saying your skill strategy is demand-led, so it means then, therefore, that you must have demand and the supply together. I know it's always a difficult in terms of the balancing act between the demand and the supply, even if you look into the language used by economics, balancing the two is always a huge challenge. But then obviously we always endeavor to ensure that there is this balance. And you'll see in the demand side, employment and other opportunities created through ERRP interventions led by these elite departments. Whether you're dealing with issues of agriculture and food security, then it means you must be working with agriculture land reform and rural development. Digital skills, working with communications and digital technologies and so on. So basically this is the work that we are doing, and I must say we have been getting a joy with regard to the work that we are doing with these lead departments. And they are quite also, they want to ensure that, you know, we are supplying the skills that are required in these various sectors of the economy. The supply, of course, what we are making there is an indication of what we do supply as the post-school education and training. And then whether we speak of bursaries, qualifications, short programs, part qualifications, and so on, because that is the work that we are doing so that we can respond to the demand as presented to us by economic reconstruction and recovery plan. Well, in the strategy, well, I should have made this disclaimer, DG, as well as honorable members, that today we are not presenting actually economic reconstruction and recovery skill strategy. We're presenting programs that are required in terms of the economic reconstruction and recovery plan. But then obviously we had to do some of the important elements or interventions within our economic reconstruction and recovery skill strategy. Obviously we are willing, if we are invited at a later stage, also to just speak only on the skill strategy. And I must say we are currently also engaged at NetLeg. We're having another session next week with the social partners in terms of analyzing the skill strategy. But then obviously we believe in fixing the plane whilst on air. So that is why then therefore we can broadly report on some of the work that we are doing in terms of the skill strategy. So we've got various interventions in the skill strategy. We have about 10 interventions, and then we'll see intervention one, intervention two, closely linked, expanding and enabling the provisioning of our short skills programs, both accredited and non-accredited, which are responding to skills gaps identified in the strategy. It's quite very critical and important. And I must mention, because this normally becomes a huge debate, especially at NetLeg, when we are mentioning non-accredited programs, especially if one looks into issues of articulation and so on, we are saying there that a non-accredited program, it must really be a program that is supported by industry associations, because we know that you might not have all programs accredited at the point those programs are required. Intervention to expanding the provisioning of workplace-based learning programs to respond to occupational shortage and skills gaps identified in the strategy. I must say this is one of the massive work that we are doing, because once you identify your occupations, your qualifications, some of them having young people in terms of our pipeline of value chain who are still in universities and TVET colleges, and they require them there for your workplace-based learning programs. So that is why it's quite very critical and important for us to have this intervention. Intervention for increasing enrollments in qualification-based programs that respond to occupational shortages identified in the strategy. So it means then therefore that the post-school education and training, now that we have identified those occupations, those qualifications, we must ensure that we're increasing enrollment into those occupations in our universities as well as in our colleges. The review and revise education and training programs to respond to occupational shortage and skills gaps identified in the strategy. This is forever critical for us. You'll see later in some of the slides, especially in our TVET environment, whereby there is a massive drive with regard to revision of our curricula. So that you can be able to respond to occupations that are required in this priority intervention. Intervention 6 is about updating the draft critical skills list and associated regulatory mechanism. Just in brief to explain what is critical skills list, there is an Immigration Act, which is within the remit of the Department of Home Affairs. Work closely with Home Affairs. In fact, the two DGs, they signed a memorandum of understanding between the two departments. So that is the Department of Education and Training. We support, work together with the Department of Home Affairs in terms of conclusion of the critical skills list. And we are working quite very closely with the colleagues in the Department of Home Affairs. And also we regularly brief our principals, Minister of Education, Science and Innovation, and Minister of Home Affairs. Basically, are those skills that we do not have in the country as we speak. It means then, therefore, you must import those skills. You'll see the skills, especially for at your NQF level 6 up, because they take time to produce in terms of our pipeline. So hence then, therefore, you know, we tend to import those skills. And then it was very interesting that we heard that United States of America has identified truck drivers in USA as part of their critical skills they need. They're so urgent to drive the economy of USA. To that extent, they are working with some organization in the country, recruiting thousands and thousands of truck drivers in South Africa so that they can assist the economy of the United States of America. Intervention 7 is all about strengthening entrepreneurship development programs. This is forever critical for post-school education and training. And then you'll see later in some of the slides the work that is being done in our TVET education sector, in our universities, as well as in our CET sector with regard to entrepreneur development programs. Because if we are really going to disrupt this trajectory or ascendance of unemployment in our country, entrepreneurial development is becoming then therefore critical, as also raised within the National Development Plan. Intervention 8 about embedding skills planning into economic planning processes and vice versa. What we are saying here is that we know that there is a lot of work that is being done in the country, whether you look in terms of Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, we've got master plans within DDIC. And then what we're saying is that those master plans, we must not wait up until the end and then someone says, where are the skills? We're saying in those processes, when you look into your project management cycle, when you start at your initiation level, so we as the post-school education and training, we must be party to those processes so that you can embed into the genes of those planning processes, skills planning. Intervention 9, to facilitate the use of National Pathway Management Network in the post-school education and training system. And normally we refer to this as the network of networks because the importance of this is that you your young people from learning to earning. So if they get into this network, they will be able to access whether it's the workplace-based learning opportunities and all other career guidance-related initiatives within the National Pathway Management Network. Intervention 10, strengthening post-school education and training system. This is forever important for us because there is a lot of work that we need to do in terms of strengthening our own system. We have identified the areas which are quite very critical, and we're happy as well that Minister, on the 29th July 2021, approved the National Plan for Post-School Education and Training System. That national plan is speaking into areas that we need to address within the post-school education and training. And then obviously that is arising out of the white paper for post-school education and training, which was approved by Cabinet in November 2013 and launched by Minister in January 2014. So we're quite very happy that now the Minister has finally approved the national plan for post-school education and training. As I said earlier on, so far we've identified some of the occupations which are associated with the Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Plan. About 103, I know when it started sometime in November, December, we had about 93 occupations. And now that we've done some validation work, of course this is work that we are doing assisted by our Labor Market Intelligence project, working with the University of Cape Town, working with the Vet University researchers. So we've identified these 103 scarce occupations. So then when we speak of increasing enrollment in our post-school education and training system, so we're making reference to some of these occupations, whether in terms of the work that is being done by CETAS, Community Education and Training Colleges, Technical and Vocational and Education Training Colleges, our universities. So this should be our guiding. But we always say we must be cautious because things are changing quite very rapidly. So we cannot say it is a finite list because there are some emerging occupations along the line. But then as of now, we are having these occupations that now we are paying attention, all of us, as the post-school education and training system. Now, you'll see immediate after this slide, whereby we've identified specifically the work that we've done in terms of rolling out some of the programs, whether it's completed or current being enrolled in our post-school education and training system. Basically, we're just making a show of some of the programs which are quite very critical broadly, if one were to say. I'll make an example, for example, on artisans. By 31st March 2021, we produced about 15,107 artisans. And very important here is that about 56% of those artisans, I think it's about 8,444 that we produced, are aligned with Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Skill Strategy or Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Plan. And also some good news, about 80% of these artisans that were produced is young people. So there must always be this link with young people if we are saying we want to really disrupt this unemployment trajectory. And then you'll also see in our artisans that I know if we look into top 10 that we're producing, it will be your electricians, mechanical fitters, diesel mechanics, plumbers, millwrights, and so on. And electricians are always top in the list in terms of the numbers. And this has been like this for so many years. And then it tells then us, therefore, that the country so require electricians. But then obviously there are other trades there that are important for the economy. Then basically it's just the work here, but then I'll show in the next slide those that are associated with the Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Plan. Okay, so if we look into this one, I mentioned about artisans, about 56% of that number, 15,106, and then the, about 56% of that those who have completed is about 8,444 who are aligned with Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Plan. And also we looked into the bursaries that we completed is by 31st March 2021, and then are aligned. Learnerships, aligned internships, the work integrated learning skills programs, and then we'll see in the far right also is enrollment. And then obviously these numbers are changing on a quarterly basis because we normally monitor especially the work of the CETAS. I know it's difficult with the universities in the main to have your quarterly figures. But then with CETAS, because they're involved with skills programs, and we have those several agreements with them, and they report in some of this work on a quarterly basis. Basically, this work you'll get within the CETAS system. But then obviously you'll see also linkages. Because if you give someone bursary, obviously that person is either in a university or a college or learnerships, are being enrolled in our TVET, private and public. Was mentioned earlier on, the collaboration between private and public. Here is just, we're just trying to show the pipeline, which is already out there, because what we do in our TVETs and universities, we normally publish the stats a year later. Like we publish the stats now, I think that was in March this year, and then we're reporting for 2019, so there is a year lapse. And then you see, these are the graduates that we are saying, then therefore in terms of the report that we published, that now are in the labor market, 346, 255. And then there we captured your exit levels, whether it's your NCV level 4, N6, and then obviously universities, it will be your graduates. Some good news to mention, especially in our universities, whether you monitor this for a period of years, you'll see that the graduates that we are producing in our universities are always your science, engineering, and technology, leading the pack of the course that we are producing. If one were to make an example, in 2019, science and engineering technology graduates that we produced were 64,686. And then business management, normally business management will always be immediate after your science, engineering and technology. We produced about 58,000 graduates in business and management. And then other humanities, 51,000. And education, 47,000. And you could see the gap is quite very huge if you compare with your science, engineering and technology, and of which it's something that we really need to support. And then it's not only the graduation part, but then also the enrollment. The numbers that we're enrolling in our universities in terms of science, engineering and technology, they are always quite very high. Just below there, it's also some interesting work that you are doing here, working with our colleagues in the Department of Employment and Labor. You'll see there were 44,843. Was now what we have done is to take all the occupations that are required for economic reconstruction and recovery skills strategy and map them against the current occupations or people who are unemployed currently. And then the Department of Employment and Labor will normally update us in terms of our basement. As I showed you that list of occupations, 103, it gives it to them to say, okay, colleagues, these are the occupations. Can you update us? Are the numbers growing? Are the numbers decreasing? And then you'll see them. But then we just took it for an example, for an illustration from 2000 up. It does not mean if you add these numbers, it will give you 44,843, but then if you add the entire list, which is quite very long, and then you'll see that number will be adding. Yeah, well, you see, we said on the other side you need electricians, but you see there that we have electricians. You know, it's always an anomaly of the labor market. We have electricians about at the time when we received this information from the Department of Employment and Labor, 4,748 who are there readily available for the labor market, forklift drivers, plumbers, product assemblers, steel fixers, call or contact center agents, fitters and tenors, carpenters. So this number is always changing, and we normally check with the colleagues. And then as the time goes on, we are going to see as to whether there is a decrease or increase in terms of the unemployed in these occupations. And also, perhaps maybe to mention, some of the areas of economic reconstruction and recovery plan, perhaps we're still busy, the implementation part. It's not that already most of them, they've been implemented, as I mentioned, those priority, those seven priority interventions. Okay, I mentioned earlier on that there is a lot of work that we are doing in our TVET sector, especially with regard to the review of our curriculum. You'll see integrating digital skills knowledge into our current programs. The department is partnering with Cisco, Huawei, to support in the updating of existing curriculum to align with industry demands in the digital skills area. And you know that this is one of the areas that we have identified in terms of our priority interventions. And with Cisco, more than 300 lecturers are trained already in our TVET colleges, and then the following Cisco certified courses have been introduced in the TVET curriculum. Get Connected and Internet of Things in the NCV, Life Skills and Computer Literacy Level 2, Introduction of IT Networking in the Hardware and Software Subject of the Information Technology and Computer Science at NCV Level 3, Introduction of Cisco Certified Network Certificate in Data Communication Subject in the Information Technology and Computer Science and at NCV Level 4, which is your exit level. Very important with regard to our digital economy. With Huawei, 56 lecturers trained and 8 certified so far at 32 TVET colleges. The following subject has been introduced in partnership with Huawei: routing and switching, big data, artificial intelligence, WLAN, and security and cloud computing. And these courses, obviously, in our TVET colleges are offered as supplementary to the ministerial funded program. And also very important with regard to our digital economy, we're introducing now a new programs in response to 4IR. We have developed a new stream focusing on robotics in the NCV Information Technology and Computer Science programs, which previously focused on programming and systems development only. The curriculum for this program, of course, is currently underway, and that is envisaged to be implemented next year. The reconstruction of engineering programs to make them more responsive to the changing industry environment. The department is in collaboration, of course, with one of our entities, which is TCTO, in the reconstructing of engineering programs to align them with industry needs and standards of professional bodies. And programs that have been prioritized, you see as well, quite very critical for our economy, electrical engineering, electronics engineering, mechanical engineering and civil engineering. This is very important as well in terms of we introduced a pre-learning program, which is quite very critical to ensure, amongst others, that students will not meet minimum requirements in the chosen fields, especially in engineering, once again, those critical occupations for us because of substandard grades in their prerequisite classes. This is to ensure that they can access successfully and in numbers to programs relevant to the economy. A review of report 191 curriculum. We're engaged in review of this curriculum for report 191, N1 to N6 subjects in different programs. Once again, engineering and business programs. 8 subjects have been completed so far, and first implementation started in January in 2021, N1 and N4. And then there is a plan to increase enrollments for occupational programs, and I must say, it's one of those areas which is quite very critical for us. And you'll see that there is a huge partnership between the CITAS and our colleges. And colleges are also currently identifying these programs that will be introduced for the purpose of aligning them, of course, with the priority sectors as alluded to in the ERRP. Well, there's been a lot of work that we've been doing as well with the CITAS, and then we've been holding a series of discussions and engagements on the ERRP content and the skills strategy CITAS, which we started in 2020 when these were still draft documents. These discussions continue into year 2021, when we're meeting with CITAS, also running some workshops with them, because the intention here is to ensure that all the planning instruments, the ERRP, is being lifted up. This is one example we just felt amongst the many that we would wish also to lift up. There is one of those massive projects that we are undertaking, working of course with the Microsoft South Africa. Here is a public services sector education and training authority center, PCTA, working with the Microsoft South Africa. We're rolling out about 20,000 of digital skills across the country, which will be touching about 2,000 young people in each and every province. The last update I received from the CEO of PCTA was that already there is close to 2,000 young people who are participating in these programs. And we really hope that we are going to massify. And I should think the other area I'll be discussing with my colleague with DDG CASA, some of the challenges that were raised by PCTA was with regard to data. Because if we were to have these, programs also, costing less or no data, I should think we might also make a huge impact in terms of them being rolled out. That one of the challenges that were raised by the CETA. But then there is a lot of work that is being put into this area of digital skills. Okay. No, also, we spoken earlier on about university education, because universities are best suited to provide skills for medium to long-term implementation for the LRP due to the nature of the qualifications they offer. We may mention that especially your N12 level 6 up, those qualifications which are being offered in our universities, and also you can closely link this as well with what I indicated earlier on your critical skills list, when we are importing those skills, because they are taking plus 3 years to produce them. However, the department is aware that the university do also offer short course programs which can address short-term interventions such as upskilling. That was the engagement that we held here. Was approved because normal universities will be planning 5 years in advance. So sometimes that's why it's difficult to tamper with their enrollment plans, because if they plan it for longer, well, of course, precisely it's because of what we have been saying, that those programs that are offered to universities, they take plus 3 years. So very important, because if we look to this plan, and obviously, as I said already to honorable members, that you'll see that graduates, majority of them, they are coming from science, engineering, and technology. And also important is that this plan includes the targeted number of graduates in skill areas, animal and human health, animal science, vet science and human health, teacher education, engineering, and life and physical sciences. We normally have these targets as well, and so that on an annual basis, our universities, they contribute. I know these numbers are quite very huge, sometimes in excess of 10,000 and so on. A midterm review for the years 2023-2025 will commence in 2022, and then that is why then therefore we're saying that also it will be an opportunity for us, to deal with some of the occupations that we need for economic reconstruction recovery plan. Universities of Technology and Comprehensive University do have industry partnership in place for work placement, but some universities did signal that they've been experiencing challenges that they build those spaces for placement due to the economic climate. Well, I must say, this challenge is a challenge that is not only facing us as the country. I was at some point looking into OECD countries, and then I found that some of the countries have been struggling to an extent with regard to the workplace-based learning programs. But then some seeming like doing well, Australia, Switzerland, but then it's always depending, in the nature of your economy and the incentives that are out there, because that is what I was telling some of those countries, OECD countries, which are doing quite very well, is because of the incentives that they do have there. But then I must say, if I was just looking into our numbers, for workplace-based learning. I know we targeted in 2020-21 for about initially for about 170,000. But then we revised that. That was during the, especially during the hard days of the pandemic to 200,000. And ultimately, we produced about 70,000 opportunities for workplace-based learning. But then we can see that there is a recovery as well in terms of some of the sectors of the economy, and we hope that we'll be able to really have more web placements. I know we are meeting also with the national departments, our colleagues, especially Department of Public Enterprises. They were saying we can utilize some of the entities within their remit so that we can expand some of the work that we are doing for workplace-based learning programs. Very important, in the midst of the pandemic, of course, realizing this challenge of work-integrated learning, USAF developed a document called Guidelines for University to Follow regarding work-integrated learning in the context of the COVID-19. Well, it's good guidelines as well, those ones which are available as well in the website. And then that was against the background of this global health pandemic, noting that we tend to struggle to get more workplaces for workplace-based learning opportunities. I mentioned earlier on the work that we are doing in our institutions, whether universities, TVETs or CETs, with regard to entrepreneurial development. You'll see that in our university education, amongst others, there is this program, Entrepreneurship in Higher Education Program, ETHE, which is a people-focused intervention, which is not only for students, but for academics and the leaders. A very good initiatives within our university sector, because at the end of the day, we know that the formal economy might not really create much work, and then you can rely much into your entrepreneurial development. And noting, I still think this will go a long way, and it needs to be applauded, especially in our university sector, because if we look into unemployment, you'll see that university graduates' unemployment is always low, in as much as we'd wish everybody to be employed. It's always some at 11%. It's at 11% now, if you look into the quota to quota labor force survey, it's at 11%. I know in quota one it was somewhere at 9%. At some point it was at 8%, it might have been the third to fourth quarter of 2020. So this drive will go a long way in terms of ensuring that university graduates unemployment is being addressed. A baseline research study on entrepreneurship development ecosystem at the South African Public Higher Education Institution was commissioned as a key project in the ETHE program in 2019. That also, a baseline study, that research is also available in the website, as you think we'll see there as indicated. Okay, well, I'm not going to get into this slide because it's just emphasizing very much the work of entrepreneurial development within our university education sector. Well, this is one of the sectors that I should think we need to do more work here. Yeah? And also, because if we are going to massify in any way skills that are required for economic reconstruction and recovery plan. I know we're doing a lot of work already. And in some instances, I know GDG Fuchane was sharing with me a graduation that you'll be taking in the Western Cape towards the end of September. It's the work between the UIF in terms of those activation labor training programs. About 4,500 graduates will be graduating, and you'll see that is a skill. That is being done in communities as well as in our municipalities. The city program is responding to the economic reconstruction and recovery plan, as I said, through building its capacity and partnerships, and city colleges have entered into partnership skill centers owned by the Catholic Church as part of expanding provisional skills provision. We know Catholic churches, they've been there for some time in terms of providing skills. So when we established the CT within the department, so then we found them, they were there doing work, and then therefore we just escalating those partnerships with them. Information and Communication Technology Partnership with the Department of Science and Innovation on the provision of ICT skills for innovation, which is forever critical. Because you'll see that when you're dealing with your ICT skills, whether it's your universities, your TVET colleges, as well as our city sector, there is an emphasis with regard to ICT skills. As well important is that the city colleges have a partnership with the Department of Basic Education on the second chance matric program as part of expanding provision for adults and out-of-school youth to acquire a matric qualification. You recall earlier on I mentioned that we're having a huge challenge here of those who are not in employment, education and training. And then we believe that our city sector is properly placed to deal with some of those skills. And even if you look into your statistics South Africa, you'll find that those with a grade 12 unemployed, that is somewhere more than 2.8 million. But those who do not have a grade 12, that is quite very huge as well at 3.7 million. So capacitating our city sector becomes quite critical for us so that we can be dealing with those cause of unemployed. The city college is partnering with a small enterprise development agency on entrepreneurial development for communities. Through the intervention, skills are provided to students enrolled in our city colleges as well as youth in communities. Here, almost close to the end, DG and honorable members, we're just showing some of the work that is being done by the National Skills Fund. And you'll see that the National Skills Fund, on average, is always funding in excess of 45,000 beneficiaries, whether in our universities, in our TVET colleges, and there's huge drive within the National Skills Fund to fund occupational programs within our TVET colleges, and very much support in terms of the work within centers of specialization. We'll set aside huge amount there in that area, especially for equipment in our TVET colleges. As you know that this program we have launched it in 2019, the centers of specialization, which is focusing on 13 trades which have been identified in the national plan for infrastructure. And you know quite very well the background was that so I think it might have been 2011, 2012 when the president announced in his State of the Nation address National Infrastructure Plan, and then we had to respond with the centers of specialization. So it's an area that we think will need to support more the NSF, the CITAS, and everybody. As reflected in the previous slides, the PSA system now we can be comfortable and with confidence that is really gearing itself to respond to the imperatives raised by the pandemic and is committed to supporting the objectives of the ERRP. And it is important to note that the supply side response, we are reliant on partnerships with the delivery departments. We have mentioned earlier on in some of the slides departments that we are working with because we can only supply skills that we know are required, and in those areas of the economy that we know they will be growing. So there will be growth in terms of employment. Some of the outcomes indicated in the ERRP skill strategy can only be realized over the medium to long term. I think I mentioned earlier on about some of the qualifications that it takes some time for them to produce, even your artisans. You cannot produce an artisan within a year. It takes more or less 3 years to produce an artisan. And as I said as well in our universities, it takes 3 years to produce some of the occupation that we need for economic reconstruction and recovery plan. The financial constraints that confront the economy and which manifest through reduced or reprioritized funding allocations are likely to impact on the ability to realize expected outcomes in the short to medium term. But then we can also assure honorable members of this committee that the department remains committed to working with the existing constraints and to continue to advance the skills agenda of the country as fully as possible. And perhaps also just to mention is that we know quite very well that on the 21st April 2020, the President announced some of the COVID-19 tax relief measures. Part of those measures was a skills levy holiday, implying then therefore that employers who are contributing 1% of their salary bill were allowed not to contribute for a period of 4 months. And then that we felt obviously because we expected to have received a revenue of 19.4 billion by 31st March 2021. At the end, obviously, we received 12.4 billion. So it turned out therefore that COVID-19 has had its own impact in our post-school education and training. As we think we've seen with numbers, there is a lot of work that we are doing, and various sectors, of course, are beginning now to recover. DG, I should think this is my last slide. Honorable Chairperson, honorable members, once again, thanks very much with this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mbalo, and thank you very much to DG Mdjwakha. Can I please note members who would like to engage on the two briefings that you received? Honorable Lord Trier. Can I note other hands, please? Honorable King, Honorable Bosho, Honorable Joko. Perhaps I should also take this moment just to acknowledge a new member of our committee from the PAC, Honorable Joko. Welcome, and we look forward to working with you. This is a very vibrant committee made up of a huge component of young people, and so we're really excited to have your contributions equally made to the committee. Perhaps, thank you, members. I see the hands are up and up high. Perhaps I should just reflect on one or two contributions. I will try my best, honourable members, to share my thoughts either prior to members' inputs or somewhere in between, so that there's a clear distinction between what members said and what I'm saying, and so that in one's closing remarks after engagement, it doesn't come across as though there's a very clear distinction between everything that members said and one's remarks as well, so that those matters are not conflated. I think perhaps if I were just to begin with the DSI, I'm of the view that, just looking at slide 9, and I know there was a renewed presentation, so some of my notes are on the previous presentation, but I'll try my best, DG, for you to follow onto which page that I'm specifically referring to. But it would be the slide that refers to the role of the STI in economic recovery, and it's got the bubbles, the bubbles that explain the role of the STI. And I think COVID-19 has really sort of lifted the importance for us to invest in science, technology, and innovation, and particularly in research and development, in building a country's resilience to respond to the myriad of issues. And so, so with the ongoing work of the DSI, we will see, with the ongoing work of the DSI, I think we are assured of the fact that as a country, our resilience will be strengthened in order for us to respond to moments such as this one, like we've had of COVID-19 and any other natural disasters or any other sort of pandemic or crisis that we may be faced with as a country. And I think, you know, just noting the impact that COVID-19 had on private sector. And let's take another matter, for example, like the recent unrest in KZN and in Gauteng, and the impact they had on private sector. It's very clear that if we are able to strengthen, you know, our research as a country in order for us to strengthen our resilience, not only will government benefit from that research, from those standing, innovations, but even private sector will equally benefit. And I think DG, as we continue to try and really learn private sector to invest in our research and development, we need to remind them of how some of the work of the DSI, you know, throughout the COVID-19 pandemic has assisted them equally in their response as private sector to the pandemic. So I think, you know, that bubble diagram really does lift the importance of, you know, how science, technology, and innovation can really boost the resilience of the country to respond to a myriad of issues. And then one would like to understand, DG, the interface between the decadal plan and the plans to respond to the EWRP. I mean, the decadal plan is something we had been working on prior to, you know, President instructing us to develop this economic reconstruction and recovery plan. And so would the decadal plan sort of be the overarching framework? And can you talk about the interface between the two then, Kikam? And then I just wanted to, if DG could explain on Pillar 2, alignment of DSI's initiatives to South Africa's EWRP pillars under Reconstruct and Transform. It speaks of manufacturing design in the transition from linear processes to circular processes with regards to the STI 4CE. And I think I'm just very interested in understanding, you know, what that transition particularly looks like, because I think generally one gets excited when we move away from linear thinking and, you know, creating more circular sort of understanding of a myriad of matters. And I think we must support the intent to localize in terms of bringing in more black-owned companies, increasing local content, and increasing employment. And then when you speak on Pillar 3, alignment of DSI's initiatives to the pillars, the EWRP pillars under Reconstruct and Transform relating to agro-processing and value chain development, it would be very interesting to see if there's any interface with IKS there, you know, just noting in terms of the agricultural space and agro-processing as well. Then I want to just highlight, and I think this also speaks to DH, and I think a number of these matters are sort of interlinking between DH and DSI. But when DSI speaks of a greater uptake of cyber infrastructure and the type of work we'll be doing around artificial intelligence and that sort of thing, and you just look at the plans under DH on slide 13, where, you know, there's initiatives around integrating digital skills knowledge into current programs by Cisco and Huawei. You know, firstly, we acknowledge and welcome this type of intervention, particularly as it speaks to social compacting. As President has, you know, over and over again really called for private sector to come on board and assisting government with its initiatives. But I think, you know, if we were to just directly speak to matters around the digital surge and how COVID-19 has placed great reliance on digital solutions. You know, we like have moved literally from e-learning to e-medicating. We can even speak about perhaps e-legislating, I don't know what we're doing as we're doing this e-oversight work of ours, but we've really, COVID-19 has really moved our country into a greater space of digital, of reliance on digital solutions. And we tend to argue a lot about access and ensuring that we have access to, you know, these digital solutions and digital resources. But I think part and parcel of the discussion around increasing access to that, what's also important is ensuring security, digital security, as society continues to be, you know, society's reliance on digital solutions increases. And, I mean, even taking into consideration that many people who would not have relied on digital platforms are now being forced to. Many of them are becoming vulnerable to various types of digital fraud or cyber fraud, and thus, you know, we really as a government need to find ways of responding to this particular need. And so, like, how do we protect, as citizens continue to make various transactions online, how do we protect citizens' e-monies? How do we create safe virtual classrooms for our children? How do we protect the data of citizens that the DSI would have collected to monitor and evaluate the transmission of COVID-19? How do we make sure that, you know, as doctors are becoming more reliant on consulting virtually, how do we protect medical records of citizens? Others are being employed digitally, or, you know, people literally have never seen the physical office of where they live. So that, you know, it speaks about how even smart contracts, what we call work contracts, but now smart contracts, are being administered digitally. You know, with all of that, what really comes across is that there's a need to have secure and trusted mechanisms in place, to have massive security arrangements such as blockchain technology that can secure and authenticate the above mentioned. And so, you know, the programs that DHET and the DSI mentioned in regard to building cyber infrastructure, this particular initiative between DHET, Cisco, and Huawei, does this capacitate young people? Do these programs capacitate young people to be able to respond to the current demands that COVID-19 has literally thrown us right into? So I think that's the question that one has there. And I mean, I think all of this links back to what DHET speaks about in terms of, the phase of reconstructing and transforming in order to build resilience. So I think I'm very interested to hear if, you know, our initiatives are responding to that, DG and Ms. Mbalo. But also, when you speak on youth-developed green enterprises under Pillar 6, DG Ndraha, how many young people will be assisted with regards to that, the youth-developed green enterprises? And, you know, if we make an analysis, are young people really taking up, what's our analysis of whether young people are taking up opportunities within the green economy? We speak about labs under Pillar 9, living labs programs that respond to the transfer of ICT skills and innovation capabilities. Are these up and running? Are these labs up and running, and where are they? And how many are they? If not, by when will they be running? And we must indicate that the reason why we ask this question, particularly with that regard, is because it's a very exciting program, and we look forward to the fruits that it could bear. Just going quickly to DHET again, I just would like to understand from Mr. Mbalo the difference between balance between short and long term, so under approach and principle. What would be the difference between balance between short and long term, and the difference between short to long term? So that would be slide 4 and slide 5. It could be semantics really, but, you know, one is trying to really understand what the difference between the two could be. I mean, I think it's how, for example, DG Ndraha, there is a difference between under dimension 1, there's a difference between expanding the provision of short skills programs and enabling the provision of short skills programs. So if Ms. Mbalo can just assist with those semantics there so that we understand the difference. And under intervention 6, still on dimension 1, you know, I think it's very important that we amplify as a portfolio committee that we must not only identify critical skills and then put them on a list, but ensure that we're able to match these critical skills with a program and with implementation. And then with regard to the SCOF, these skills and then, you know, use them in the market.
How are we involving local government into the sector when we talk about renewable energy? How we encourage them to ensure that we bring more renewable energy players on board so that we don't have this over-dependency on Eskom to provide electricity in the long run. Then also on the Platinum Valley, I also saw on the slide that it was earmarked to be completed, the Limpopo Science Technology Park, by August 2021. I just wanted to find out if it has been completed, the estimated cost of completion, and when will this park eventually open, and the real objective of the Platinum Valley Park going forward. Then we get to page 40 of the DSI indicators. The one thing I would have liked to have seen on there was the knowledge and skill exchange that is going to happen during the industrialization process in order to ensure that we have a proper reconstruct and recovery program so that we cut off over-dependence on other countries and we actually send the skills out to others so that we can expand on the market. So that is one indicator I would have loved to have seen that we will be measured on during the industrialization effort of the department. The Department of Higher Education, a lot was said and we listened to it, but it sounds when the presentation was made as if we are talking on things that still needs to happen, whereas it should have happened long ago for our country to achieve proper skills development and to ensure that we equip people in the jobs market. So the presentation had me a bit confused in that regard. Also to yesterday in the news, you would read that we will have a mass exodus of educators in South Africa. And yet you would find a misalignment when NEFSA decides they are not going to fund yet students. So if you see a missed exodus, and you know we will might sit with a situation where we would have shortage of educators, would it not then be prudent to do a proper investigation or analysis on the areas where there will be mass skill shortages and then align NEFSA funding towards that in order to achieve the desired goals? My one concern also that I have is with CETAs and the TVET colleges. The TVET colleges, we forever talk about the concern that we have with the outdated curricula. In some instances, we are concerned with lecturers that might not have the required skills and we are upskilling them. So my thing is, where does the CETAs and TVET colleges link in particular sectors to ensure that we upskill those students for the job market? How are the infrastructure going to be utilized between the two sectors to ensure that we actually receive the desired skills out of DEED? Because I find it actually disconcerting when a statement is made that in the long run, short to long run, that universities are best equipped to deal with it. Yet, in other countries, you would see the focus is more on TVET colleges in order to achieve this, and the research skills further is then through universities. So I would just like to know from DHET, how serious are we in order to ensure that TVET colleges actually become the focal point going forward in order to push through these skills needed in the market at the moment? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Kim. Honorable
Borsho. Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just want to share my face for a moment and then I'll take it away again because of predictability. I want to respond very short on the DA's presentation, where I, can, in a sense, link to what the Honourable King has just said, that the community education and the TVET colleges have this very vital role which has been outlined today again, but it is a little bit staffed in the way of the budget, and it will be disastrous to take money away from universities to give it to, the, to these, because then one would, you know, destroy something that you have on a high level and put it somewhere else in the hope that the other sector will also will excel as a result of it, but you have to have a guarantee. So I actually don't know where the money should come from to let these colleges play the role, the vital role that they should do. But that is just my way of passing. In fact, I want to respond to Dr. Mdwaha's presentation, especially if one looks at slide number 13 with a map where all the different interventions or some of the interventions are graphically presented. And I want to know, I see that the or the department wants to produce a green ammonia in the Northern Cape. I believe it's because there's a lot of sunshine and one can do it only, you can, it's the type of plant that you can let work when the sun shines, and if it sets, then it's no problem, you start up tomorrow again, different from a, let's say an iron smelter which has to work 24 hours irrespective of daylight. But why would that then be transported to Mpumalanga for the fertilizer production? It seems interesting, well, it seems peculiar to me, but there might be a good reason for that. I would just like to know about it. And then also the whole question about the astro-tourism in the region of the SKA, Dr. Ndwaha made several references to the whole SKA area around Carnarvon and projects which has been launched to counter the negative economic influence of taking 130,000 hectares out of production in the area. I would like to know how well is the communication with the farming community, if he thinks it's a possibility that the farming community can also benefit by it. I must say I am in that region very often, and the SKA is still a very unpopular institution in the area because the people have the perception or they have the experience that the SKA says another thing every now and then. At the beginning it would have very little impact on farming, then it would have a little bit more impact, then some land would have to be purchased, then a lot of land had to be purchased. So there is a perception that you can't really take the SKA on its word. And then I just want to add another little idea which I think links in very well with what the DSI presented. If one looks at the present setup in the Karoo, you could say that you sell the energy of the sun in different forms, mainly mutton or wool, but it is dependent on the rain. The sun's energy can't be sold on its own. It depends on the rain and the biological process to have something to sell. Now, the production of green hydrogen and ammonia production are both industrial processes which can work only with the energy of the sun. It doesn't mean the need rain like a biological process. Now the question is it foreseen that this will happen in, let's say, large-scale industrial plants, say in some of the big centers like Kimberley or Upington or wherever, or could the idea be that just as every farmer or every farming unit to stabilize these farming communities, because the Galloway is actually a nice place to farm. If it rains every year according to the average, then you can count on it. But because it doesn't, it's a very unstable farming area, and that could be stabilized by this kind of micro production units, and that could be to the benefit of the whole area. That's my questions, because I am, you know, I represent that part of the country, and it's very relevant to them. And maybe if I could just ask from the aid, are there any ideas, or is the department open to the idea of public-private partnerships in connection with training of people to be able to do some of the services, to render some of the services to the SKA? Because in the previous engagement of the Adams, well, they actually agreed that a lot of money is being spent on upkeep and maintenance, but that the knowledge base is not available in the area, and that means that money goes out of the area in any case, because you have to import the people doing the jobs, and then they go back to their homes. While I'm aware of a group of engineers around the area of Golfinia who are very eager to get involved into the training of young people to be able to, you know, to use this expenditure on the SKA to the benefit of the direct region. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Borshoff. I think some of the things that Honourable Borshoff speaks to are so important with regards to particularly the SKA and Nyasgat, and I think that's why one is really looking forward to the oversight visit mid-October, as it's been scheduled in the program of the committee. Honourable Joko.
Thank you, Chair, and also thanks for the warm welcome to the committee. I just have a few questions to raise. One of the issues for any plan to work effectively is a proper consultation with all the stakeholders. Otherwise, that plan might not work. Considering that the plan, it cuts across many departments, when the initial plan was developed, was it in consultation with some of these departments, or you just took a global view of what other departments are doing and you developed the plan? Because I see that, and also the cost implications of the entire plan, because it's quite exciting. It is an innovative plan to respond to jack up even the functioning of the entire economy of the country. But for it to work, the other stakeholders need to pull together for it to make it work. And also the cost implications of the plan. It might not be the plan it, knowing fully well how much it will cost rent for rent, but just a global view of what it might take for the entire plan to be executed. The second issue is that the aspect of innovation, sometimes it does not mean that you need to do massive things, even small things. If they are done in a smart way, they are innovation. Like, for an example, the biggest challenge for upcoming SMEs is the bottlenecks in terms of funding. As part of the innovation plan, is there anything which is being done in that regard, which might even cut across all departments, so that it makes it easier for the SMEs to uptake and to be successful? The other issue relates to this one goes to the DDG. It's a specific case, because noting that you are the the suppliers of RPL, the recognition of talent. There was a case because institutions of higher learning seems not to be in line with what the department is saying in that regard. There was a particular case of a retired Sandow Kenner. He only had standard 6 of formal schooling, but throughout his life, working life, he had worked in the legal fraternity or engaged in some legal work. Now, once he retired in the army, he wanted to pursue his work. He wanted to study further with his standard 6 formal education. Now, he was confronted with a situation where this university would not allow him to study because he does not have the requirement, which is a matric certificate. Now, he had to go to court, and the institution was compelled by the court of law to register him in that institution at the age of 64. He has now finished up his studies. He is now writing his board exams to be accepted as the advocate of the High Court. Now, these RPLs are the institutions of higher learning in line with what the department is saying in that regard, because this was not even supposed to happen. If there is recognition of prior learning and is there in the department, which is also regulating the institutions of prior learning, this pensioner had to use monies to go to court to access education, which is a constitutional enshrined right. Now, I want you to reflect on that one a little bit, because it might not have been an isolated case. There might be many cases like that where people are trying to upskill themselves and they are confronted with that situation because they do not have the formal, what is considered formal education. For now, I will pause there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jogo. Honorable Isiye comes through, I think I just had left to mention that that we send our condolences to the family and friends of the Walter Sisulu student who was stabbed to death on Monday night in an altercation between himself and another student. I think we're still awaiting the final sort of results of the investigation with regards to this. So this is in terms of him being alleged by another student, say it's alleged at this point until the investigations confirm it. And, you know, we really send our condolences to the family and friends of this Walter Sisulu University student. And I think, you know, just noting the amount of incidents, Honorable Itzia, that are taking place in our institutions of higher learning, there's a lot of work we need to do with regards to social cohesion and addressing a myriad of social ills that exist within Boer society and are now infiltrating into microcosms of society like our institutions of higher learning, where young people should feel safe. And so, you know, I think it must be really heartbreaking for our parents to be thinking they're sending their child to school where they'll be learning and they'll be safe and they'll come out of the system with the skills and knowledge to contribute to the family but also to society at large, only to have your child return in a body bag. I just think it's really, really sad. So condolences to the family and friends there. And I think it also just sets a huge task for us also as a committee and a sector at large to look into these matters. Honorable Lizier.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning to all honorable members and colleagues from the department, both Science and Innovation and Higher Education Ministries, staff that is here. But I also want to welcome, like yourself, Chair, Honorable Joko, and for the first time, Honorable Laudriette, to the Portfolio Committee. It's a pity Honorable Joko did not put in his video, so we could not really attach the name to the face. Usually, we do ask Chair that they show their face so that at least we are able to attach, because we are on virtual platform. Honorable Mananiso has forwarded me a question because she's suffering from network challenges. And a question to Mr. Mvalo is that you mentioned the challenges that you are having in terms of rolling out your ICT skills by PCTA. And the question is, what engagement do you guys have, whether it's a skills branch or a PCTA, with network providers or operators and the Department of Communications to try and resolve this problem? And that is on the involvement of YES program. I think that's what in fact, on the involvement of YES program, she's asking, are you guys considering those who are above the age of 35 years to be included in your YES program? That is from Honorable Mananiso, and from me, I think to both departments, we must agree that key to the economic reconstruction and recovery plan is the fact that we ought to use the budget that we have effectively and efficiently, use it constructively, you know, so that means we can't get the ERRP well if, you know, we're not using the money that is allocated to ourselves correctly. So my question to both departments on this one is all those who are involved in the ERRP, have they received a clean bill of health from the Auditor General? Because I don't think if the Auditor General says, let me use PCTA for an example, the department is using PCTA as one of the ERRP drivers, and the Auditor General comes and say, no, you guys have received an irregular expenditure of this much. I don't think that would be sending the right message. It means, you know, we are not driving this ERRP well. You know, we're not on the right track in terms of the recovery, reconstruction and recovery plan of the economy. If the drivers of such a good policy, you know, do not know how to use their money efficiently and effectively. So that is to both departments. And now I'll go to maybe let me start with the higher education one. You've also noted that Mvalo, I think it was in your page 2, and I apologize, Chair, if some of you would have asked this question. I think I was also, when members were asking questions, I also experienced a little bit of network challenges, so I could not hear all the questions from all members. So that Mvalo, you mentioned on page 2 that there is one university that is considered to be medium risk in terms of completing your academic year, because there was still some way to go to complete semester one and the assessment associated with semester one. Can you please share which university is this? And also share with us if the university in question did complete semester one on time. And then what are the reasons for universities in general not to comply with aspects related to the timer's recording of semester results, and how does it impact on the final results and certification of students, those who are completing at the end of that particular academic year? And then how does it impact broadly the teaching and learning in that space? And then page 6 of your slides, you are also noting that a task team has been established to work the details of the provision of lecture laptops for TVETs. Can you just take us through what is the status of procurement of those laptops, the status of the policy relating to funding models and management of those laptops? When will students be included in the provisions of those laptops, and who, or rather, how will they be funded when you include the students? And then maybe you please assist us with the commitment in this regard. And then the funding module, when are you envisaging that you'll be able to complete that? Maybe also take us through what is the status of NSFAS allowance disbursement, if there are any challenges in that regard. And then maybe to science and innovation, DG, then you... will you have any the STI programs be devised to support ERRP from science and innovation? We know that the department's program of support compromised many existing STI initiatives to enable the step change envisaged by the ERRP. Is there an acceleration or an expansion in the current implementation of your plans or project goals and or time frames of any of these initiatives envisaged? If yes, which initiatives will be prioritized? What changes are envisaged? And how will you, how will those be supported and resourced? And then if you can just give us how will you measure the impacts of this thing. And if no changes to the current STI initiatives and resources are envisaged, is it merely an exercise that DG to ensure departmental initiatives are aligned to prevailing plans? I think actually I would like to thank you for this question, but also I've noted that on the platform, Honorable Yabo has got a brother or sister, Pumelele Yabo, on the platform. So it's nice to see that Honorable Yabo has got a sister in the department, one of the departments. And that was on a lighter note. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Itie. Honorable Yabo.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. In actual fact, I was going to start off by saying that I see on the list of participants there is someone who shares the same name. I'm not sure whether there's a relation there, but I've interacted with them on Facebook in the main. But if you are family, then at least I've got some backup. Just to run through my questions, and I'll start off with the Department of Science and Innovation with the presentation made by DG Mdwaha. And before I continue with the questions, Chair, let me also be part of the chorus that welcomes the Honorable Jongo to the portfolio committee. We would have loved to see his face, but the time permitting, we shall do so in future. On the reconstruct and transform pillar, with the reference to hydrogen fuel cells, I see there's a timeline attached that only in 2025 will the 50 buses and the 50 heavy trucks be fitted with to be powered by hydrogen. I want to understand why is the timeline put at 2025. What are the constraints there? What are the bottlenecks, if any? I also see that there's also reference to the Water and Sanitation Master Plan. And I want to ask a question.
No, I'm busy on my phone.
Due to the challenges that we may experience in some parts of the country, especially where sanitation still remains locked in the doldrum years, and sanitation has not yet become waterborne or any other modern technology that may be used for infection. What attempts are being made by the department to find a solution that does not require heavy capital resources to implement in dealing with the sanitation problem, especially in the remote areas, in far-flung areas, where you may not necessarily have wastewater treatment works plants there? Is there a plan to deal with that, and how is it also integrated into the ERRP program for the department? Understanding that the department is transversal in nature, and I do that, I know that there has been some development of certain technology that may deal with the sanitation problem. Well, sanitation, if not dealt with, becomes a huge problem. And so my question is, are there attempts by the department to look into technologies that are less capital intensive, perhaps more labor intensive? And even if they are not labor intensive, but are able to create much needed jobs to be implemented in the remote and far-flung areas of our country where waterborne technology may have not yet arrived. I also want to speak to a question around the department's participation in the extraterrestrial space. And by that I mean, in the ERRP, the contribution by the DSI, I have not seen, except for the SKA, I've not seen where the department speaks to probably setting up capabilities for South Africa to become involved in extraterrestrial launches. Put it in easy English, the launch of satellites for participation in the communication space and owning the such hardware in an African country. And I know that that space has been dominated by the Americans, the Russians, in a great extent. But are there plans afoot with the DSI, that's the, as a leading country on the continent of Africa, to participate in that space? And what would the protocols be that would restrict such participation, if any, internationally? My next question would be, with the generation of these innovations that have been presented to us, especially under the various pillars of the ERRP, what is the percentage of interaction with SMMEs from the cradle stage? And also throughout the life or the cycle of innovation to grave, where grave means throughput from what would have been a concept developed throughout a period of time. What is the percentage of interaction with SMMEs? One, at cradle stage; two, at intermediary stage; three, at the throughput stage. And how is that then quantified in relation to economic output, number one? Number two, job creation. And I speak of this within the context of the development of a capable state, as well as the fact that I believe that you cannot leave the markets to dictate development or human development. There has to be some level of state intervention. And so the hand of the market being controlled and or influenced by, rather let me use the term influenced by participation of the state, by making sure that SMEs are involved from cradle to grave, but at which point at the cradle stage do we have SME involvement, at the intermediary stage do we have SME involvement, at the output stage do we have SME involvement, and to what extent at each of those critical stages of development. And of course the question then, the economics, how much in terms of economic output are we looking at that is accrued to the SMEs. Number two, how many jobs then are created to the various demographics with specific focus on women and youth. How much of these interventions are also linked to, and I've heard the DG speaking, making special mention of the fact that there is a lot of international work being done. And I mean, for me, international also includes the continent of Africa. Being able to interrelate within the continent of Africa with other countries, and of course, the enabler being the recent agreement on free trade, on Africa having a free trade agreement amongst the countries in Africa. How much of the work that is being done is also being channeled to creating markets and or cooperation between other African states, such that once the innovations we are seeing presented here, the hydrogen fuel cell technology, food security, as presented with an agro plan to innovate food security by making sure that there's also little food waste, aggressive infrastructure investments, interfacing with SMEs, developing innovations. How much of this is also pushed to ensure that the free trade agreement is exploited in the best sense of the word to the benefit of the country and its need to create much needed jobs? It is shocking that we are now sitting on 34% plus of the unemployment rate. One of the biggest problems with that is that you then have a youth bulge of unemployed young people who are sitting idly, whether with qualifications or without, which becomes a ticking time bomb. And I think we would have seen how the availability of a large working class has the potential of wreaking havoc with the recent looting spree in KZN and in Gauteng, where you have in a short space of time a large number of people who literally overrun security forces to do as they please. And the cause of that is that we have a huge unemployment problem. And so my questions on the presentation by Dr. Mdwaha speaks to those that I've already mentioned. As far as the presentation made by Dato Zogile, my question then is, because DHET as much as the DSI are transversal departments in terms of being able to slot in the various competency areas that are presented represented by other departments, it becomes worrisome when you have a slide that says you have from the TVET sector certain occupations which are unemployed. Now, the question I have on that, and he made special mention of the fact, Dr. Mvano made a mention of the fact that electricians are the largest cohort of these unemployed graduates from the TVET sector. Why is that? Why do we have such a large number of graduates within specifically designated qualifications being unemployed? Are the qualifications the problem, or is the problem the availability of the work that they can be slotted into? I need to understand why, when you have such qualifications. Is it because they are not able to fit into the workplace? Are they not able to perform? And therefore, the market rejects them, or what is the issue there? Because it's alarming that you have such a high number of graduates who would sit with those qualifications you would think are a requirement. I mean, fitters, antennas, plumbers, electricians, and all others that I may not remember at this moment, but it is quite alarming that you have such a large number sitting idle with those qualifications. Then you would have thought that because we are pushing towards an industrial trajectory in this country, they would be employable. The last thing I want to speak to is, in relation to the CETAs and the throughput of the skills development channel, I see in the slide that the amount of money that the CETAs collectively would have collected through levies would have amounted to approximately 19 billion, but because of the incentives granted by government, they are now sitting at a point where they have to collect 12 billion collectively. But how much of that is really channeled to creating a capable workforce that is in demand, especially if you are going to speak of the reconstruct and transform phase or pillar of the ERRP? And can we be given the timelines of the ERRP in real time, right from the first pillar where you're dealing with containing the pandemic, making sure that the infections are not rampant, right through to the reconstruct and transform pillar of the ERRP? How much time are we going to take in order to bring back the economy on its feet, reduce unemployment, deal with the Gini coefficient? We have the highest Gini coefficient in the world. That should be worrisome to all of us. How much time are we going to need to cut down the Gini coefficient, create sustainable jobs, industrialize, and ensure that these innovations by the DSI that are spoken to today become commercialized to a point where they are able to address some of these challenges we're experiencing? How much time is actually needed? And I'm asking this in the most pragmatic of terms, not pie in the sky type of terms. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very, very much, Honorable Yabo. Honorable Makesi.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon to everyone. And thank you to the department for both presentations. I just have just a couple of questions that I would like to engage the department on. First of all, I think I just want to also just add what the previous speakers just mentioned, that there's some kind of disjuncture between the vacancies that are available that are not filled because we have shortage of skills, and yet at the same time we have those people with those kind of skills not filling those vacancies. So I just want to find out, what is the reason? Is it because maybe we are producing students, or we are producing graduates that are not fit for purpose, who cannot be absorbed into the job sector, what is actually happening. And also, one particular example is the engineering sector. What we have seen is that we went to an extent whereby we brought children engineers who came and basically were prioritized over over South African engineers to come and fill in positions. So I just want to have a better understanding, because I see that as a big disruption in terms of making sure that like our graduates do end up getting jobs, and instead of saying that, you know, they're sitting at home, they're unemployed, but then their vacancies are not being filled. And also, I just want to find out also as well, like, once you have completed your degree or your diploma, it looks like there's no clear indication of maybe even an understanding of where you should go to try to find work. Because if we say that there are gaps that are not filled, and you have people out there who are constantly applying for jobs, but they are not getting jobs, despite the fact that they have the qualification. So how can we be able to resolve that issue? Is there a way that, you know, maybe we can have labor centers that can be the ones who come up and have lists of vacancies that are available, so that our young people can know not only what is available, but what our country needs? Because we need to have, this cannot be something that we discuss behind closed doors. It has to be something that is out there, so that even those who are completing their metrics, they know, you know, the job market, where they should go, and which are careers that are more likely to end them up into a job or give them a job opportunity. The other issue that I want to also bring to your attention, Chair, as well, is the issue of when we're talking about, you know, what is it that we're doing in terms of, because I'm addressing the last presentation. The department has come up with this program that will be able to open the economy and provide job opportunities for young people and those who are unemployed. First of all, COVID killed economies. We know that globally, and so we need, obviously, as you've stated, we need to increase stimulate our economy and increase demand of what our country needs in order for our economy to expand. But I didn't hear the department talking about, you know, transport. Transport is also another way of increasing our economy, because then you will allow our citizens to be able to be mobile. Because currently, you know, for anyone to really be our transport system is not as efficient as it should be, and it's not even as competitive to countries that have economies that are growing, that are gradually growing, and also growing at high speed. I mean, that is one thing that maybe can also be included in terms of trying to create jobs for the citizens. The other issue that also came up was the macroeconomic intervention. I didn't hear any interventions that were brought about within that topic. So I would like to find out, you know, what is it that when you talk about macroeconomic intervention, what are we talking about? Another issue also is the issue of energy. South Africa doesn't have energy security. And, you know, in order for any economy to be able to function optimally, we need to have energy security that is more, you know, sustainable, that is affordable, and currently we don't have that. I know that the department, we spoke about, you know, you spoke about solar and photo solar energy that can be able to help and sustain the country. But that process as well, it looks like, you know, is on the sideways, and things like wind turbine and all that. But what I've actually realized now, or even heard, is that the fact that now what we are hearing more about nuclear as another source of energy that we know that the country is looking into. I don't know if you can elaborate on that, because that was something that was brought by the Zuma administration, and now again it is coming up. So I just want to find out, what are we doing in terms of energy security? Because there's no economy that can expand without having proper energy security. And also, you know, there are a lot of kind of niche jobs that we have been mentioned. Like, for instance, you know, when we talk about solar technicians or even wind turbine technicians, I don't know how much work can those really create. Surely they will create the energy that we need. But in terms of jobs, like, you know, because you cannot compare them to the complexity that comes with Eskom. Eskom is our biggest employer, we know that. And so solar plants, we're talking about, for instance, if you do have a solar plant, you'll have your supplier that will give you a guarantee of your plant, and you really don't need as many technicians that will be responsible for that. I might be wrong, but I just would like to also find out what if we're talking about wind turbine, how many technicians are we talking about? How many jobs are we talking about? Because it's one thing to also say that, like, you know, we have this plan, that this program that we have, and yet we don't have the numbers of how many jobs will this plan create. So that will also, you know, it will also give us an idea to say, like, no, okay, from wind turbines, we're going to create so many jobs. If we're talking about solar plants, we're going to create so many jobs. So so that, like, you know, if you're saying that these are the strategies that we have to create jobs and also to increase our economy. So I would like to maybe to get more, more input or more meat on those things. And the other thing that I need as well is the integration into the African continent. It was mentioned, but I really don't, I don't know how we're going to do that, because I also brought the issue of transport. In order for us to be able to move around, even within the African continent, you cannot take a train and go to across, you know, different countries within Africa. So it's something that maybe we should actually look into. And also, finally, to revive the tourism. We mentioned that, you know, that we need to revive our tourism sector. But currently we are in lockdown. We are basically, like, you know, most countries are locked down and they cannot leave the borders. And I think South Africa is one of those countries. So we really have to look at local tourism. I think that is another way of stimulating the sector itself. So what is it that we are doing to ensure that, like, you know, South Africans themselves within the country, they can move around? Because if you look at flights, a family cannot afford to go on vacation. They cannot afford planes to go to Cape Town, because everything has become so expensive. So I think we need to find ways of how we can be able to revive tourism itself, but how can we actually make it even more affordable, so that South Africans can be able to move around and be also the ones who stimulate that economy. I think that's about it from me, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Makesi.
Honorable Sibiya.
And thank you so much, Chairperson. Thanks for all the presentations. Mine is regarding the existing FTI initiatives. My question is, will any new FTI programs be devised to support the economic reconstruction and recovery plan? The last one is, what is the role, what role does the department and CSIR have in the establishment of the artificial intelligence institution as it has been indicated on page 31 of the ERRP? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Sibiya. Honorable Mashati.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good afternoon, colleagues. Chair, let me also apologize for not being on a video network connectivity. First and foremost, let me welcome both presentations made by department. I would like to start with the science and innovation presentation with specific reference to slide 10, where we're speaking about ensuring energy security. I just want to find out with the department, what exactly is the collaboration with Sasol in their transition from a gray to green hydrogen and a green ammonia? What exactly is the contribution of the department in that space? And I'm raising this thing precisely because of the environmental perspective that are at play in as far as the Sasol Beck area is concerned and in as far as the air pollution is concerned, because this is an urgent matter. It cannot be postponed, and I think people of the Free State have been crying over the issues of air pollution in that particular area. Therefore, the contribution of the department in expediting this particular process will actually be play a fundamental role in that particular society. Number two, Chair, is on the slide 18, where we speak about mass public employment. On this particular slide, I see there is a program that intends to employ 100 young people within the MTech period in relation to Mzansi Enviro Camps. Can we get an indication how would this particular program be run, how much it will cost, to ensure that we don't just put plans that are not costed? Equally, when you look at slide 6, which speaks about the green economy, also there the objective is to have a youth enterprises. The issue is both programs, they seem to be targeting the same sectors. Both programs seem to be doing almost the same thing. If there is a difference between the two, can we get an indication what exactly is the difference between the two programs? When you look at Pillar 7, which is slide 21 to 22, where we're speaking about agriculture and food security, what is the relationship between the Department of Science and Innovation and the ARC, the Agricultural Research Council? Because when you look throughout their presentation, there is no way whether such entity, which is quite critical to our research capacity, is the intention of the program is to support on those improved yields and climate change resilience. The issue is at this point, ARC is also doing almost the same program where they are actually working on therefore, if the department does not necessarily have a relationship, it will be double dipping for government, for the state. Therefore, what then becomes their role in partnering? Why are they not partnering with them? Equally, on the animal vaccines and livestock traceability on the same slide. As we speak, foot and mouth disease is a key focus for the Department of Agriculture, precisely because it bears high risk threat to the sector. Therefore, this particular program that is presented on particular 21 and 22 speaks directly to the same program that that particular entity is actually working on. What then becomes the role and their relationship. I'm also equally excited, Chair, about the Biosecurity Research Hub. Would also want to know at the Agro Innovation Hubs, these particular programs that will enhance our international trade, especially when you speak about agro-processing in the rural areas. It is what the country needs at this time because it would unlock socio-economic inequalities of our people, especially in the rural areas. When you go to slides 26 and 27, you see they are the slides that refers to RDF's contribution to the ERRP. We see figures of 34 million for direct and indirect employment or support to beneficiaries. Can we get an indication what exactly we mean as direct and indirect so that there's clear a distinction between the two? And how did we arrive at the investment of 34 million? What will this 34 million include? If the department does not have specific the specific responses, can they be in writing, Chair? Similarly, on slide 28, we're speaking about also figures there, about 53 million, slide 28, it speaks about the program where the full cost of a program is going to be 60 million. Can we get a clear indication exactly how much would you spend on what in relation to this particular program on slide 28? When you go to slide 29, the department speaks about partnerships with, CSIR, NPGO. But why only these four departments or entities that the department has decided to build or to have some sort of partnerships? Why are we not broadening our horizon in as far as building partnerships? Because these partnerships, especially with the ARC, partnerships are not only at a level of monetary value, but also play a fundamental role in data sharing and assist to enhance the research capacity of government. So when we build these relations, it's not only because Nikagawena Wanaga Nikagamina in terms of monetary bill. We mean that you ought to science and innovation is a very critical aspect in terms of where we are as a universe. So we really need to enhance building much more streamlined relations with other entities and possible partners to enhance our research capacity. Now, when you go to slide 37, Chair, you see that there we are speaking about access to market, which is one of the critical aspects in terms of building a sustainable state. How is this program? How does the department intend to support us? What do we mean as when we say we are supporting access to foreign markets? How do you do that? Can we get a specifics to say this is exactly what we are doing as the department? Equally, Chair, you know, when it comes to international trade agreements, it is important that the department specifically indicates how do we, what are the current agreements in as far as in international market is concerned, and which countries currently are we having these agreements in the Department of Higher Education? Be very quick there. Unit 11. I think colleagues have covered most of the questions there, so I would just have two questions. When you on slide 11, we speak about the progress on the implementation of the ERRP skills strategy. This progress is from, I'm not sure when, but up until the end of last financial year, which was the 31st of March. an indication on this particular slide to say what was the target? Because to check whether are we succeeding or are we progressing on an upward mobility, we should be able to measure the success based on the target. Because here you are just saying completed and enrolled. What was the actual target of the department? Because that would give us a glimpse in terms of these particular courses or beneficiaries that has been, who were supported on scarce occupations, whether the department has been able to progress upward. And equally on the issue of, having scarce skills in the country, and I'm not sure whether it's an accusation of government in as far as taking engineers from other countries. I think it is quite important for the department to also to give us an indication that, you know, as we sign these agreements, they are not limited to just a monetary value. They are also subjected to skill transfer and skills development. Therefore, issues of engineers that are coming from other countries, it could have been part of the agreement with this particular country. This is what we agreed to. We have seen during the COVID-19, when the pandemic started, we saw so much excitement. While we have doctors, it does not mean we must overlook our own young people in the country who are skilled, but also we need to assist ourselves as members of parliament, as members of the committee, in terms of the trading agreements that we have signed with these particular countries, and what does this particular trades include in those agreements.
Honourable Whip, we've been trying to, was a bit challenging, and I think you did indicate that your network is problematic, hence you'd be keeping your camera off. I'm hoping that DG and Mr. Mvalo were able to hear you, because you were breaking from time to time, but I chose that maybe if we were just patient enough, we could try and gather what the Honourable Whip was saying, but just at a few points, it wasn't a lot, it wasn't the majority of your input, it was just here and there, but I think DG Ndraha and Mr. Mvalo would have tried to get your points. Yes, Whip?
I wanted to check at what point maybe you might have lost me. I can just indicate a few, maybe come through for those particular aspects.
Perhaps what we can do is allow for DG and Mr. Mbalo to respond, and then if they need clarity with maybe parts that they feel like they didn't hear clearly, then they will revert back to the work.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mahlatsi. I see Honourable Makesi's hand is up. Honourable Makesi, I will give you an opportunity to add, but I really would like to urge you to try your best, and have the majority of your inputs gathered by the time it is your opportunity.
Yeah, no, I'm apology about that. I just forgot a few things. It's regarding the programming that the second presentation was the EWR key program. I'm aware that that there's going to be a partnership with Microsoft on that, but I just want to find out if there will be any incubation centers that will come out of that, or satellite training centers, because usually those kind of programming, they're not practical, they are more like they're not theoretical, they're more practical. So I just want to find out if there's any plan for that. And also, given the fact that, we've lost so many jobs, is there any way that, the department has actually brought the issue of reskilling the people that lost jobs and who have found themselves with in jobs that are basically, are not have, are not going to be necessary anymore. So is there a way, like, you know, that those people can be basically reskilled? And also the issue of people that are unskilled, like, because we have people like in ESCOM, for instance, that are there, that are unskilled. You know, what happens in the situation where you have people that are sitting in jobs that are basically, like, you know, they are not skilled at all? And given the fact of what we saw recently in ESCOM, whereby a generator busted because of they were, you know, people that didn't know how to properly utilize that. Thank you, Chair, for the, you know, opportunity again. It won't happen.
No, it's fine, Honourable Mackenzie. I mean, you are at work, and I think it's just an indication of the fact that you are passionate about the work that we do. DG Mdraha, DG Mvalo, there are a lot of questions and a lot of comments that have come to members, and I hate to add two more, but it's part and parcel of the job that we have to do. Perhaps I'd just like to get clarity on whether there's anything significant between the Mr. Mvalo. On slide 15, we speak of pre-learning programs, and we really think this is a great initiative. Is there any reason why, beyond just say an issue of semantics of wording, why they're referred to as pre-learning courses as opposed to bridging courses, which were historically used? I don't know if we've eradicated that particular term of bridging courses to pre-learning courses or programs. I mean, I don't know if there's any difference with regards to that. And then on slide 18, there's an initiative, there's a myriad of initiatives that are listed there, but there are no time frames as to, you know, when it's supposed to start or if it has started, because we're noting that some of these are existing programs that will be integrated and form part and parcel of the economic reconstruction and recovery plan. Mm-hmm. So there are no time frames listed there on page 18. Can we have those, please? with regards to university education, slide 20, it speaks to targeted number of graduates for the sector and increase the targeted number of graduates for the SCOS skills of, and then it says teacher education. You know, I have a concern or fear of how perhaps we tend to want to mass produce educators. But I am really concerned on the type of curriculum, and I've said this before, that educators receive, and I want to put on the spot, I want to put the University of Africa, because I've gone through their postgraduate certificate in education program, and I don't think it's on par. Yet so many young people are going through their PGC program, and I found myself making many corrections on the study guide. When you look at just, you know, there was a part of the study guide that spoke to the digital gap, and the picture there was still a Nokia 3310, I think, or something like that. And I mean, when we speak about the digital gap, where educators are supposed to exist in under COVID-19, you can't use such as examples, you know, and even around issues around language, and I could go on about, you know, spaces where I think the curriculum at UNISA in particular needs to be reviewed, and I think it's very important that the department just zooms into that to make sure that as we invest in increasing the number of educators that we have, that we don't mass produce educators that can't respond to the demand of the economy now. The WIL, I just want to note that I must make sure that it continues to exist within the realms of COVID-19. That it must continue to exist within the realms of COVID-19, and COVID-19 mustn't be used as an excuse for why people can't have opportunities in relation to work integrated learning. If I could just have clarity with regards to the entrepreneurship higher education program that was established in 2016, if I'm not mistaken, on page 21. I think it's a very interesting program, and it could, I mean, some of the questions we asked in relation to slide 11 speak to why are these young people unemployed, and perhaps a program of this nature, which I think in your previous presentation that you shared with us last week, if I'm not mistaken, you spoke about how you want to have these, you know, entrepreneurship opportunities within TVET colleges as well, so that young people can be able to really trade with the skill that they've been given. So it would be nice to know if this EDHD is rolled out at a nationally or departmentally centralized level, and how it sort of then trickles down into your various institutions, and what the interface is between the department and the institution in terms of demarcation of responsibility. If there's a note here on page 23, it says bullet 5, slide 23, it says the earmarked funding within the CT allocated budget is being utilized to fund skills programs and capacity building interventions. The net effect of this is limited interventions by the CET colleges. I think this is concerning, considering the fact that a whole lot more funding is required for CET, for the CET program. And generally, I'm of the view that the CET program needs a lot of attention. On slide 25, it speaks to NSF, slide 25, bullet 2. The NSF has committed funding for 90 TVET infrastructure site construction and or refurbishment and equipment, and I think this is also an area of concern, considering the fact that and I think it just speaks to the general funding limitations in both departments, both Department of Higher Education and Department of Science and Innovation, because ideally the NSF should not be funding infrastructure, but should be funding programs. And it almost feels as though we're playing musical chairs with the funding within the department, you know? And that is not sustainable. And I think many members have spoken to the funding constraints that we have within the two departments. And of course, lastly, it would just be, you know, and I think, I'm not sure if Honorable Yabo, Honorable Lipi, I'm not sure who spoke to this, but in this economic reconstruction and recovery plan, I think it's also very important to place the economic recovery and reconstruction that could have to take place post the unrest in KZN and Gauteng, and how do we factor in these young people? I think I said this last week. How do we factor in this in-service training that must take place into the opportunities that may come out of having to rebuild malls, and how do we, you know, coming out, for example, from this entrepreneurship, what is it called, this EDHE, how do we assist some of these young people, the SMMEs DG, how do we assist these young people in having businesses that could exist within these malls that will then have to be rebuilt and reconstructed? I think that's something for us to just ponder on as we go forward. There are many matters that members have raised. It's 12:25. Both DG Mdraha and Mr. Mbalo have to respond. I'd like to state that can colleagues really prioritize responding to as many questions as possible, but also the very key critical questions that were asked by members, and you know, other questions that need really finer detail and may need the support of a particular document, I'd like to request that they be submitted to the committee in writing. Thank you so much, DG. Over to you, and then to Mr. Mbalo.
Yeah, thanks very much, Chair. We have taken detailed notes on each and every question that's been asked by members. But again, I'm not so sure how much time you want between myself and Mr. Mvalu to respond to these. It's about 25 past. Do you want us to split sort of half an hour between ourselves to be done for you to have 5 minutes before the end? Just some guidance.
Can I urge members if we could perhaps push ourselves to maybe 13:15. Hopefully some members are not moving, are not in transit to move to the house and are maybe virtual, and therefore we could just, I'd like to urge that maybe we try push it to, where are we now, DG? But can you divide 45 minutes in half? So maybe we'll push it to 15:20 so that you have sufficient time. 25, okay. 25.
All right, thank you very much. One of the offer I would like to make, Honorable Chair, is the offer we made at the beginning of this administration, where we said we are available to share the broader strategy of the work that we're doing, the roles and other line departments. Because if you recall the first set of slides that we made as a presentation, we indicated, and this is perhaps a response to your first set of questions as a chair, that our contribution to the ERRP will be informed by the decadal plan that we are now completing. Because we see the things that are proposing the decadal plan as being a framework within which you can support the various pillars of the economic reconstruction and recovery. So we did indicate that we are almost at the end of the consultation within government on this plan, and if the chair would create the space for us to share the programs that will arise out of the decadal plan, would appreciate this, because a lot of questions that have been asked would become clearer as we finalize that. But I want to start by saying, key to some of the proposals in the decadal plan is lessons that we have learned in how the work of the department and the investments that have been made in the national system of innovation have not been taken up by other government departments. And this is Honorable Lotrit's question. And in doing so, in the decadal plan, we are making a couple of proposals. The first one is that it is important for the role of science, technology, and innovation in the economy and social development and support capable states to be an agreed agenda within government, and hence the proposal of having the interministerial committee and the proposal to agree on research, development, and innovation plans that would support the sectors of the economy that are in other line departments, and agree on an innovation compact. So those issues are in the decadal plan, and they would solve some of the problems that we have picked up over years. The second issue that we hope to have as an institutionalization of how science and technology can be taken up by others is the budget coordination. This again responds to Honorable Lodrit's question, where we have a proposal on how budgets could be coordinated across government, national, provincial, as well as local as well. And Treasury has then agreed to work with us in developing this concept further, including the process on how the MTEC process and the MTEF process would be structured to make sure that there are budgets that are earmarked for science, technology, innovation activities in other departmental plans. So this is work in progress, but the framework and how this can be done is in place. And then the third issue, which we hope in the decadal plan as part of the
recording stopped. Recording in progress.
Of the interface is the issue of a role clarification, because there was a framework which was agreed in 2004 by cabinet, which is called the strategic management model, that tries to define the roles between us as a Department of Science and Technology at the time and now innovation. Which areas of science and technology do we fund and are expected to fund? And which area of science, technology, and innovation should be funded by other line departments? Just briefly, we were given the responsibility to fund new and emerging areas of research, the bulk of our budget, and then a certain proportion of the budget to fund research and development that could support other departmental mandates, so whether it's issues of small business, energy, agriculture, and so forth. We hope that when we have demonstrated what could be done in agriculture with those investments, then the full rollout would be taken up by that line department. And thirdly, on areas of standard technology services, we would not be involved, but we are proposing in the new model that we should get involved. For an example, I'm sure the honorable members who are in Cape Town would have seen a discussion happening between the police and the KwaZulu-Natal Research Innovation Sequencing Platform, because the capability of sequencing, genomic sequences that we have been using to support the mutation of the COVID-19 virus has now been seen as something that can help the police in reducing crime using DNA forensic analysis. So the point, though, is that we hope then in this IMC that is coming up to clarify these roles, Honorable Latreat, so that we can really get commitments and firm agreements through the Innovation Compact, through the agreement on the research development and innovation plans that would support mature industries and new industries with other line government departments. We hope that would address both the issue you've raised around the uptake by other government and budget cuts, including this budget coordination mechanism, and then the sustainability thereof. I also then want to wrap this part up by responding to your second part of the question, Honorable Chair, in terms of what is it that we are doing in the ERRP and its interface with the Decadal Plan. Now, what we have learned as far as COVID-19 and the ERRP is concerned is that the investments that were made, and I will make a couple of examples, long time ago, can be repurposed to support ERRP. So in certain instances, it's not necessarily new programs, but it's to pivot the investments that we had in order to support this reconstruction, economic reconstruction and recovery. And as you saw in the slides, we did say, how are we responding to the engagement and preservation? What are those programs from the investment of the past are going to help us to just make sure that we preserve and engage? The NPDO has been extremely useful. The investment that we made in the biotech area with the sequencing of the genome and the network that has been set up, the work that we are supporting at MRC, understanding, for instance, the effectiveness of these vaccines through clinical trials, so it's engage and preserve. So it's not necessarily new work, but it's the repurposing of the work. However, if you take the investments that we've been making in the vaccine production at BioVac, it's old investments, but we are linking that investment together with the work that's been done in universities, and hence we are now going to be producing this mRNA vaccine for the rest of the continent through building on that. So that's a little bit of recovery and reform. Because you will then sell these vaccines, somebody will buy them, and then you are beginning to reform your economy to be an economy that exports. And then, of course, reconstruct and transform. The example of the work that we are proposing in hydrogen, where, again, huge investments over time have been made, and we are now going to address the issue of pollution in Mpumalanga. We are going to address the issue of reindustrialization through beneficiation, because that's what we're doing with the hydrogen fuel cells, and then the production of clean energy. So it's a new way of doing things. So I hope that helps in terms of this conceptual clarity that you requested from us in terms of what this is and what it is not. And I also hope that it addresses the issue that was asked by Honorable King. Sorry, Latreat. I have asked Mr. Patel to talk about the living labs, the work around the green economy, including what we mean by secular economy. I think this is a question that has been asked, and the cybersecurity, so he will respond to that. I've asked Rebecca to talk about the hydrogen as well as some questions asked by Honorable King on the Limpopo Science Park, as well as the green ammonia question that came from Honorable Boshoff. So that will be maybe including the micro-production ammonia issue that was also raised by Honorable Boshoff. I hope, Rebecca, you can also respond to the question raised by Honorable McCarthy on the work that we're doing with SASO. And then I also asked we can say a few words on the Africa Free Continental Trade Agreement and the approach there and how we intend to do that work. And then if Fiona wants to respond to Honorable Matlatsi around why the four in the setting up of the NPDO, because those are the ones that we started with, but the work of the NPDO is meant to serve the whole of government. And then maybe Imran can also, or Rebecca, if not, I will add on the issue of the partnership with the ARC and the work that they are doing, just the approach. And then Honorable Makesi on the issues that relate to transport, energy security, and nuclear. I will come back to that if the time allows, in terms of not responding directly to the questions, but the fact that the line departments are supposed to come up with an energy strategy of the country. Our role is to say what is it we can contribute from the research, development, and innovation perspective, either to support and or to inform a strategy from the research development. So we can't comment on the nuclear, but if a decision has been made on nuclear, we think we can contribute in terms of how we can use the nuclear build program to build your own local capacity. And one question which you also asked, so the same with transport. We don't develop the transport strategy. It's the Department of Transport, but if they have a strategy, we can say this is what you can do differently in your strategy to incorporate new developments in technology. And then just one response from me on Honorable Makesi is the issue of macroeconomic interventions. We don't have any contribution because we are not involved in the monetary policy, amongst other things, and how you can use it as a lever for driving economic activity. We don't think from science, technology, and innovation we have any expertise or skills or investments that we've been made in order to be able to do that. But for the others, with your permission, then, Chair, we can ask Mr. Patel 5 minutes, Dr. Rebecca Masaremule on issues relating to platinum value and hydrogen, and maybe Dan to talk about the issues that relate to African Free Continental Trade. If time allows, I will still respond to Honorable Boshoff's questions around what's happening in Carnarvon and the consultations we would have. So I hope you'd allow that, Chair. They can, in about 5 or 7 minutes each, take us to 15 minutes. So Mr. Patel, followed by Rebecca, and then followed by...
Thanks, DG, and good afternoon to all of the members. Just quickly, because of time, on the Living Labs, Chair, we have 5 that are operational in Buffalo in the Eastern Cape, Kwakwa in the Free State, Athlone in Western Cape, Kwamashu in KZN, and Ketumene in KZN. In the current financial year, we're evaluating on a basis of a call for proposals, setting up some additional Living Labs. The current indication are by December, we would add to that portfolio with the 3 further Living Labs. But the Living Labs is part of a broader program that includes other kind of interventions like M-Labs, etc., and we are trying to find an effective way as part of our transformation framework work to bring that all together so that the kinds of questions you asked around demographics and beneficiaries, etc., can be represented at a composite level as opposed to the individual projects. So that's work in progress, and we're hoping to bring that to the portfolio committee. In terms of the green economy / circular economy, I do want to, for purposes of this discussion, separate those things out for now. The green economy traditionally is looked at from the perspective of energy. There was a question asked about green economy R&D expenditure, I think, by the Honorable King. We have done work around green economy R&D as well, but we can share that at some other point in time, or we can just put a few points in response. But on the green economy, we have work that Rebecca will speak about in the energy portfolio. But from my perspective, we also do a lot of work in the waste sector. It doesn't necessarily equate to the circular economy. The circular economy is, in some way, people talk about it as not a different economy, but about making your economy more circular, which means recycling a lot more, making sure that when you design products, you think about its end-of-life use, etc., and it's a much more longer-term agenda. We've done some important, what I call foundational work in that area, including something that I think will become a lot more common as this progresses, and that's called material flow analysis, where you actually do in detail, you look at your economy and where is it that the things are being used, like metals or whatever, and then on the basis of that, what are the opportunities for making that more circular? We do have small projects that have started the circular economy thinking, but I think at another point in time, that's a whole conversation on its own, and we can share that on that. So I hope I've answered that question around the green economy, circular economy. On cyber security, yes, we have been doing work with researchers. We've been supporting it, but I would want to answer by just focusing on, I think, what the DG has highlighted. ICT has become so pervasive and so cross-cutting and so integrated in a whole lot of issues. So moving forward, what we are increasingly going to be focusing on as a DSI is what we call foundational digital capabilities. These foundational digital capabilities then can be drawn on by people who have to apply these capabilities in particular settings. So we've identified a whole range of these: artificial intelligence, blockchain, cybersecurity, etc., and busy working with the CSR and a number of universities to look at how deep is our capabilities in this area, and strategically how do we invest at the deep level, at the master's PhDs level, at the kind of researcher level, core capability at a high level across all of these. So in that context, cybersecurity would be one of those application areas. The cybersecurity work is special in a sense. It's globally accepted that you need to build a certain level of sovereignty in terms of cybersecurity. And we do have work in that area. We work very closely with the security cluster departments a few years back, where there was a composite cybersecurity strategy, and as part of that composite strategy, RDI was one of the elements of this composite strategy, and we've been continuing to support that work. I think we need to enhance that. I think based on your very relevant comment that COVID has accelerated the digitization, and with it, the challenges of security breaches, etc., that we need to do. You also raised the issue, Chair, of the data protection and other issues, and just to indicate that we now have set up a kind of a platform where, together with industry and other government departments, etc., we can think through and develop the deep governance arrangements for things like data protection. It's something called the Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution South Africa, which I think we will feature in some of our future presentations to the committee in our quarterly report. And then the final comment is on the ARC, and I want to broaden it out. I think there were some comments made by others around what are we doing in the water and sanitation area, etc. So we can broaden out that issue with the ARC. Even though the ARC and Water Research Commission, etc., report to other line function departments, we work with both the department as well as the entity. As an example, I'm on the board of the WRC. We've always had members of DSI on the board of the ARC, and many of our programs are implemented by the ARC and the WRC, so we don't necessarily only fund programs that exists within the DSI family of entities like the CSR, etc. We also fund outside of that, but increasingly we want this to be done in a much more stronger partnership with those line function departments. This includes the MRC, WRC, ARC, etc. SINEDI is an example. And let me leave it at that. I know that there's a lot to get through, DG. Thanks, Baba.
Yeah, I think the detailed number of EnviroChamps, Imran, I think that came up quite a lot, and these programs in the mass employment scheme. So what I would like to suggest, Chair, can we write up all the responses to those issues and submit it to yourself in the interest of time? We've got the responses to all of them so that we can give Rebecca a chance on the hydrogen stuff. And then perhaps one or two questions still on the funding, on the indicators, which I'll come back to later on, and the Africa Free Trade Agreement. So if Rebecca can help us with that, followed by Dan, and then I'll come back. So hopefully we'll give enough time for Mr. Mvalo to respond. Thanks.
Thanks, DG. Thanks, Chair. Honorable Bashaf, in terms of your query around the decentralized green hydrogen and ammonia production. I think the current market for green hydrogen is sitting at around $0.3 billion. And in 2028, it's expected to grow to $9.8 billion, or by 54%. Now, the way in which South Africa will participate in that market is if our green hydrogen is at the same cost as other countries. And everyone is working towards moving towards $2 per kilogram of green hydrogen. And the way you do that is by a kinds of scale and large production of renewables. So you need to do it at megawatt, a gigawatt scale. And really, Northern Cape is the best part of the country where you can get gigawatt scale production of solar energy. Now, I think we should look at it as an opportunity, because in order to split a water atom, you need to actually bring water to the Northern Cape, because Northern Cape does not have sufficient water. So essentially, what's going to happen is they're going to desalinate water in order to produce green hydrogen. And because the cost of the water is about 10% of the total cost, we could ask the facilities that are desalinating water to desalinate more than what they need, but to also support development in Northern Cape for agriculture and other purposes. So I think I just wanted to bring the point that the reason why it's decentralized in Northern Cape is because of cost. Now, we did a study that if you do put green hydrogen production in Limpopo, KZN, or Gauteng, the cost would be brought down to $4 per kilogram. So that means that if we do that, we're not going to be competitive with what's going on globally. And in recent news article says that even Namibia is trying to get green hydrogen production at $1.8 per kilogram. Now, in terms of the question from Honorable King around the science and technology park, the role of the DSI is not actually to build the park, but to support them in their aspirations to be a tier four data center. So data centers have different tiers. So like tier one means that you store data sets, but then your energy backup is very weak, or it's very simple. So we're bringing in fuel cells in order to help them with the backup of their data center for energy. If you look at tier four data centers in the rest of the world, like Google, Microsoft, they're using fuel cells for backup power. And recent studies have shown that I think you can get a fuel cell to back up for a close to 30 to 40 hours of backup power in an event that there's a power outage. So our role is to actually assist them in the status or the level of tiers for their data center. And the study that we're working on with them will be completed by the end of September to analyze how fuel cells and solar energy will assist them with powering the data center for the Science and Technology Park in Limpopo Province. The question from the Honorable Yabo around the number of trucks, you know, fuel cell trucks on the road, why is it taking so long? Why is the timeline up to 2025? Now, there's three constraints. Okay. The first constraint is cost. The second constraint is a lack of local manufacturing. And the third constraint is policy and regulation. Now, with regards to the first constraint, the hydrogen fuel cell truck is actually more expensive than a diesel-based truck. Part of the reason is because of the existing fossil fuel-based subsidy, but also because the upfront cost is much more expensive because you don't have as many on the road. So we're actually doing work to see how to bring the cost down. And the only way to bring costs down is with economies of scale. And then in terms of lack of local manufacturing, locally we don't manufacture fuel cell trucks. So also we're trying to put in place the manufacturing because you don't want to, you know, bring so many into the country, but then you're purchasing them from abroad. So we're actually working with SMEs as well as OEMs to see if we can do enough to have local manufacturing in South Africa, such that if we put the trucks on the road, it will provide jobs for South Africans. And last but not least, policy and regulation. If you put a fuel cell truck on the road, unfortunately, if you get into an accident, the road accident fund will not cover you because you don't pay taxes on it. So we need changes to the regulations to allow fuel cell-based trucks to be on the road. And in terms of the Honorable Makhlatsi, in terms of the work that we're doing with SASL. So in terms of the SASL work, air pollution issues, essentially the reason why you have air pollution challenges is because you have flue gas, which is being, you know, vented by SASL. And, you know, flue gas is made of greenhouse gas emissions, which is CO2, noxious SOXes, and then particulate matter and heavy metals. So what we're working with SASL to do is to actually demonstrate how to capture the flue gas and turn it into what we call carbon-lean fuels using like methanol or diesel using green hydrogen or green ammonia as an input. So we're helping them with a couple of things, raising funding for demonstration projects. So the SACHEPS program, which is the Science and Technology Sustainability Program out of Japan, is bringing about 70 million rands to South Africa to support the large-scale demonstration and scale-up of green ammonia production. Secondly, the other work we're doing is we're helping them with the training of the technicians that will be on site for the green ammonia production facility. And this is really important because if we're moving into a global hydrogen economy and trying to sell hydrogen globally, we need to have production locally in South Africa. And your chemical sector is probably the easiest, you know, companies to support. So we're in the process of signing an MOU with SASL to co-fund research 50% around the demonstration of carbon capture and use, as well as green ammonia production and scaling up. And this is supporting two of the policy intents of the white paper, looking around revitalization of existing markets or sectors and supporting a green economy. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Rebecca. Dan, on the Africa Free Continental Trade Agreements and what's our intentions there.
Thank you very much, Director General, and good afternoon to the Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of the Committee. The first point to emphasize, Honorable Members, is that when the Department of Science and Innovation engages with the opportunities of the Africa Continental Free Trade Area and indeed the broader domain of international trade, we do that as an integral part of Team South Africa. It is not an engagement we do on our own. We take leadership from the Department of Trade and Industry and Competition, and of course the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. So our efforts in this regard is really coordinated, and we're an active participant in the work by the government cluster on international cooperation, trade and security. And then when we speak about using the Africa Continental Free Trade Area and international trade opportunities, we specifically refer to market opportunities for technology-intensive products or services, wider offerings which come from our national system of innovation. How do we access international market opportunities for these products, if you would like, which were developed as a result of investments by the DSI and other funders in the NSI? And why do we do that? Three key areas. One, of course, as was indicated by the Director General in his presentation, is to respond to the imperatives of the Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Plan to get increased revenue for South Africa from foreign trade. But secondly, and that's also to just ensure the sustainability and access international investment for the NSI. For many of or several of our entrepreneurs and technology intensive enterprises, often their value proposition or their products have too small a domestic market. So it was very important. It's very important for us to assist them in order to support the sustainability of their work to gain access to international revenue through international markets. And our work in hydrogen fuel cell, satellite technology, in the bioeconomy, etc., offers many examples where we have a value proposition to offer to international markets. But thirdly, there's also the objective, consistent with our government's priority, to support intra-African trade, to make sure that we gradually change the patterns of where trade patterns is dominated by North-South relationships and not intra-African relationships. And then how do we practically achieve this? First of all, we work very closely with the DTIC and DERCO to include actors from our national system of innovation, such as the CSIR, but also non-DSI entities such as Mintec, as part of international trade promotion efforts. So a very practical example is, the honorable members may be aware, South Africa will be participating in the Dubai Expo, where we will be marketing South Africa as the international trade and investment destination, and we will include, as part of that marketing effort, a strong focus on the science, technology, and innovation sector in South Africa. But secondly, we also want to use international research and innovation cooperation, specifically intra-Africa cooperation, as a lever, as an instrument to access foreign markets. Through international research and innovation cooperation, one builds relationship between actors, between academia, but also between academia and industry, and business-to-business relationships. So we want to use that as an instrument where, in the first instance, we may be working with a country on a research collaboration, and in a second phase, access the market for selling our technology products and services in that country through the intelligence we have gathered through the research collaboration and the relationships we've built. And a very practical example, for example, is we work with Madagascar on research collaboration on the use of nanotechnology in the mining and mineral sector, for example, in wastewater treatment or mineral extraction. Now, our strategic intent there is to position the South Africa offering of nanotechnology-related technology platforms as seeing Madagascar and other African countries as a potential future market. And then just lastly, we also work under the leadership of the DTIC in the negotiation of international trade agreements, including the implementation of the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, where we are sensitive to make sure that tariffs or non-tariff potential barriers do not inhibit the trade, specifically the intra-African trade in technology and other innovation intensive products and services. So we want to be sure that the international trade regime, the international trade markets of Africa is party to, is also sensitive to the specific priorities and objectives of our national system of innovation. Thank you, Honorable Chair and DG.
Thanks very much, Dan. Maybe then 2 minutes, Chair, to say that we want to make some proposals because we realize we haven't done justice to all of the questions. For an example, we would like to propose that on the issue of hydrogen, Platinum Valley, we come and brief the committee on all the aspects of it, even though Rebecca has made an attempt to respond to it, including the questions asked by Honorable Boshoff around the microgrids and the plants that will be set up for this ammonia production in the
in the Northern Cape, and why ammonia must go back to Mpumalanga. The details of that would be enriched through an engagement. The second proposal relates to the issue of the not so same understanding or communication at different levels on our engagement with the farmers in the Northern Cape around SKA. We would like to have a very detailed conversation with yourselves. If you would like us to do that, either as part of your visit, maybe we find a slot either before or and maybe as we fly to Carnarvon, we're more than happy to do that, because we have a range of platforms and structures that we use in the Northern Cape to communicate. So if there are different understanding of what's happening, we would like to create a platform to have that conversation. The third issue relates to, these are just the 2-minute responses to Honorable Yabo on our space program. We're happy to come and share with him the details, both from the launch to value-added products and how we can use this for high-tech manufacturing. He's also asked the question around the cradle to grave around our engagement with the SMMEs from the Technology Stations program, the TLAU program. He wanted to know how to quantify the exact, if you like, output and outcomes of that. We've got that detail. In the meantime, we can submit that through your office, Chair. And then the last contribution then is the issue that was asked by Honorable Choko on the ambition for this plan and the amount. The target is gross expenditure on R&D as the percentage of GDP of 1.5 by 2030. So that's the number at the moment. We're sitting at 0.78. So private sector, the public sector should invest to get that target. And then Honorable Yabo, we are working on the indicators of performance for the ERRP, so we'll be more than happy to share those with you. So that's where I would like to stop, Chair, in the interest of time, so we give our colleague from DHET also a space to respond to some of the questions. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, DG. Mr. Mbalo?
Thanks very much, DG, Honorable Chairperson, and members of the committee. And then I must say that our questions were quite very comprehensive. I'll answer, Honorable Chairperson, some of them. I must make indication that my other colleagues from various branches, DDGs, are also present, and then we'll come later to add where I might have not answered properly some of the questions. If I will start with you, Honorable Chairperson, you were asking, and I'm happy that DDG Patel also answered this question, with regard to cybersecurity. As you know that, especially since the arrival of COVID-19 in our country, we have been very much digital. In fact, we were forced to be digital. Something we are learning along the line, we should have done long before. It's like operating on these virtual platforms. This is what we should have been doing. But then we were forced and compelled by COVID-19 pandemic to enter into this space. And very important now then is the question of cybersecurity. I must mention there are a lot of initiatives that are being undertaken currently, especially by MICT CETA, the CETA which is responsible for this area of the ICT. Interestingly to note as well the bank CETA, because you know the banking industry, because it's very much working digital, and some of the men were working even during our alert level F5. So they were very much on the digital space. So there is work that is being done there by the bank CETA, and also noting that these are transversal skills, and also by other CETAs which are closely involved in this work. Another, I know, Chair, you were asking about this thing of balancing between short and long term. Perhaps maybe if I can answer this by making an example. And I can also commit if the honorable members of this committee would wish us to come specifically and speak on the skill strategy, because today we're just focusing in the main on the programs that we are currently running. But to make an example around balancing the short and the long term, we know currently that we're having about 770 apprentices within our TVET sector. So what we have been doing in that area, it has been to ensure that we have got the infrastructure and everything and equipment is in place. The work that we are doing there, and now for the first time, some of our TVET colleges will be doing trade testing. And we know trade testing is quite very expensive in the private sector. And in the main, we have been relying at Injela, which is our public trade testing center. And now this work is going to be done in various TVET colleges. So it tells us then, therefore, that while we are investing in the work of our economic reconstruction recovery plan, we must take into account also of our future. The investment of today will be good for the generation of tomorrow. Just make an example around the work that we are doing with regard to the centers of specialization and methodology, of which we have done also our midterm review, and then there are good and positive outcomes that are coming out of that process. I must also mention, Honorable, you were also asking the period as to, you know, the information that we are reporting for which period. And obviously, the information that we are reporting with regard to the work that we have done for economic reconstruction and recovery skills strategy, it was for the period up to 31st March 2021. And obviously, on a quarterly basis, as I said earlier on, we'll be able to report to see the progress in terms of the rolling out of some of the work identified in the interventions of the economic reconstruction recovery skill strategy. And obviously, I mentioned as well that if you look into the work of universities, you are having your medium to long-term programs. Because if someone is entering university to do ICT, that will take that person 3+ years. So obviously, then we are not going to be able to be reporting on those areas on a quarterly basis. The other question you were asking, Honorable Chairperson, was around the affordability of these programs, because it's quite very critical. If we go back into the word version of the skill strategy itself, we'll see there that in each and every intervention, we've identified actions. Part of those actions is to say how we'll be funding these skills that are required for economic reconstruction and recovery plan. And we've identified, amongst others, an emphasis that the Secretary of Education and Training Authorities, as well as the National Skills Fund, even though not excluding other departments, because this is not a matter for the postgraduate education and training, only it's a matter for the entire country, that we must provide the skills that are required for economic reconstruction and recovery plan. So we are committing in the skills strategy, amongst others, that we'll be having specialized window periods whereby the NSF, whereby the CITAS will open the window periods. As you know, that the environment is being regulated, that CITAS will be having windows during certain periods of the year. But then we're saying in terms of the skills that we require, we need to make it a point that we are making funding available. Obviously, the fiscal is there because it will continue to play an important role. Honorable King was also asking Honorable Chairperson a general question as to, it seems as if what we're talking about is still something to happen. And I can confess to Honorable King that it's a bit of a both. It's something to happen and it's something happening. Because we know, the honorable members, that for the first time to hear about the economic reconstruction and recovery plan, it was in October 2020. So that implied then, therefore, that we, as the Department of Higher Education and Training, we had to develop a skill strategy. And under the circumstances, you still have to consult, because we cannot develop the skill strategy as the department and then we just run. Because we are having here lead departments, as I mentioned earlier on, we must consult with them. We are having NetLab, which is a very important platform for social partners in terms of the NEDLAC Act, that you cannot bypass it. We've got National Skills Authority, which is empowered in terms of Chapter 2 of the Skills Development Act to advise the Minister of Higher Education and Training on issues related to skills development in the country. So we have to do all that, because we would have not wished to have a situation whereby we're having many more people complaining to say we have not consulted and we do not know what you're talking about. Because as I mentioned in some of the slides, this is about the social partners. It's about us as the country. It's not about the department itself just going and running some of these programs. I mentioned, for example, on the part as to what is that we have already done, that we have already beneficiaries, more than 13,000 in these various interventions that we have identified, who are readily available, as was stated here, in various areas. And then obviously, we know, I know there were some questions around, you know, why we're having also about 44,000 plus in various critical areas. I should think it was Honorable Yabo was asking that question. 44,000, you've got plumbers, electricians, what is the problem here? The work that we have done so far is also telling that in some areas, those who have completed some of these programs, it might be that the curriculum was not so specialized, or else there was no workplace-based learning, or shall I say, you know, workplace experience. So people, they need their workplace experience, and we know what's happening in the country. If you complete a degree, or you complete a trade right now, and then there is a post, there is always this element of 3 years or whatsoever experience, which that itself is an impediment, because there is no way that someone who's completing a trade as an electrician, in as much as we know that if you are training an artisan, you train the artisan at a workplace, because you cannot train the artisan at a theoretical place. Most work is being done at a workplace. But then obviously the employers, before they can employ me as an electrician, they would wish also to have some strong test of me having some experience with regard to those areas. So that's the challenge. And also obviously, we're speaking of your soft skills, your work readiness programs. And now we are raising that quite very up in terms of our interventions, because we know it's a challenge of those who are unemployed, but they do have qualifications that we need to assist them with regard to the work readiness. Honorable Chief was asking about the issue of network providers, as to whether is there a work that we are doing so that we can assist, especially rolling out of this 20,000 digital skills by PCTA. And we just received the report this week when I was just checking the progress with regard to the work that is being done in that area, whereby I mentioned that we have been just close to 2,000 of those who have been already rolled out across the country in digital skills. So DPG Gasa will come also a bit later, maybe about 2 to 3 minutes, just to speak as to what we'll be doing with regard to assisting on matters related to data cost, because what we can only do is to meet with the CETA and see how can we intervene as a department at our level. There is also this important question that was asked by Honorable Etier with regard to who is qualifying for YES. Indeed, as you think, as a country, we all agree that the challenge that we are faced with is youth unemployment, especially those who are between 15 to 24 years. Unemployment, as was stated here, is somewhere 64.4%. And then you can look into other cohorts, and we'll see that unemployment is a bit lower. Those who are not in employment, education, or training, that is somewhere 3.3 million. In fact, one can round figure that to 3.4 million. So it tells us therefore, that we need to focus on young people in the country, and we know the recent report by States SA with regard to mid-year population estimates is telling us that young people are in excess of 20.6 million out of about 60 million of those population estimates. South Africa is a youthful country, but then of course I must say we cannot exclude others, but we must be able to prioritize our resources where we think the vulnerable sectors, youth, women and people with disabilities. So then that is why you see that the YES program is targeting those who are between 18 and 34. But that does not mean that these are the only opportunities available across the country. So I think I tried to answer Honorable Yabo's question, especially with regard to the question of why we're having them not employed. I know in some areas there is a requirement for a professional designation, of which that itself is requiring someone to go into a workplace. And we know it's a reality. The country was closed down, whereby the estimates are that for the first few months of COVID-19 implementation of those regulations, about 40% of the 40% of the workforce was working. And the implication that we're having is that employers, obviously, they will prioritize their own employees. If you have to have 40% of people working, you are going to prioritize your own employees, because all what they are concerned with mostly is the question of your profit, your profit making. But then we're saying as well, we are seeing now that the economy is beginning to open up. Those are the good news, and also the president announced that those who are between the ages of 18 to 34 also are going to be inoculated. It means then, therefore, that the employers are likely to come to the party. Because I know it's difficult. Even in your own house, when you see the person coming for the first time, you are not sure as to whether Mbalo is COVID or not. So it's the same with the employers. It's a challenge to welcome this a newcomer within the workplace. So now that everyone is getting inoculated, I should think it's going to go a long way in terms of incentivizing employers. I must also mention what we have done. We have increased apprenticeship learner grant. It has been for many years 165,000. Now we have increased to just over 206,000. Meaning we stand therefore. Employers who are hosting apprentices, they are no longer going to get 165,000, and now they will be getting 206,000. It is one of those measures. Even if you look into OECD countries, there are similar same measures of trying to entice employers to come to the party in terms of your workplace-based learning programs. I mentioned earlier on, I should think I was surprised, though we have not met the target, because I said we revised the target from 170,000 to 100,000. We have achieved 78,000. Then I was not expecting that, that employers would be able to open up their workplaces for about 78,000, especially young people in their workplace. So it tells us a good story that the employers are going to open up as inoculation is being now rolled out across the country, especially to young people amongst others. Well, there was also the question as to whether, I should think that was also from Honorable Yabo, do we have a budget, you know, that we can pin into it with regard to the work that we are doing in terms of the economic reconstruction and recovery skills strategy. All what I can mention now is that the work that we are doing, we know quite very well that all sectors, we get 1% from the payroll. Of employers who are having a payroll of in excess of 500,000. 1% of that amount, then it goes for a skills development levy. 80% it goes to the SITAS. 20% goes to the National Skills Fund. That 80% it goes to the SITAS. We have segmented it. We have 10.5% which goes to administration, a budget, and we have 20% which goes to a mandatory budget. And we have 49.5% which goes to discretionary budget. Out of that 49.5%, we have 80% which goes to a pivotal program. Pivotal programs are those programs which are associated with your critical and scarce skills. That is why we have bursaries. That is why we have work integrated. We have work integrated learning and we have apprenticeship, we have learnerships, and so on and so on. So we know that we have got that 80% of 49.5% of 80% of 1%, which is a huge budget if you look into it, that we are investing into these areas of critical skills, which are so required by our economy. I know Honorable Machesi was asking, I think I've also answered, by the way, the question of the graduates as to what's happening with the graduates. I said earlier on that graduate unemployment in South Africa is at 11%. We would wish to have everybody employed, but then it tells us some good story that our universities, their training that they are doing is a quality training. Employers, they are welcoming our graduates into the labor force. Those to us are, of course, good news. The issue as to, I mentioned earlier on the National Pathway Management Network as part of the interventions in terms of the Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Skills Strategy. Part of that, you're dealing with your ESA system. The ESA system is a system within the remit of the Department of Employment and Labor. What's happening in that system is matching the demand and the supply. So it's whereby if I am unemployed as Mvalo, I can go to the system and then I can register myself. The employers, they are also making use of that system. So that's why we're saying we need really to market that system because it's a good system for the country. You mentioned as well the tourism sector. Yes, we fully agree that perhaps it will need for us to be creative. We've been meeting with the departments, and we've met with the Department of Tourism, and the very issue they've raised with us was that the sector is struggling. Obviously, we know that if you look into foreign arrivals, there's been a huge drop from about 15.8 million to 5 million if you compare 2019 and 2020. That is somewhat about 71%. That had implications with regard to the tourism sector because you do not have people who are traveling to South Africa. By implication, if you look into our accommodation, whether it's hotels and the like, also they are having a serious challenge. To an extent, some of them, they have closed down business. So colleagues were saying to us, when we're saying, well, we have identified some of the skills occupations within the area of tourism, so we need them to come to the party in terms of opening workplaces. But then they said, we struggle with workplaces, but then we committed, of course, as a department, that we'll work with them. But then honorable members will know how as to supply skills. The other departments, including us, by the way, we should be offering opportunities for workplace-based learning and employment. It's difficult for us as the Department of Education and Training, which was supplying skills, also to guarantee someone employment. But all what we could do is to ensure that our curricula is responding to the needs which are required by the industry and the work that we have been doing. So I think the slides we have demonstrated, the work that we are doing with our TVET colleges, with our universities, as well as our CET colleges. We know it's a mountain, but as we think we have started already, we are seeing some positive indications with regard to demand-led kind of skills intervention as opposed to a supply-led skills intervention. As you think, the last one, that was also from Honorable Chairperson about when you mentioned about the digital skills rollout by the PCTA, she was asking when this started and when this will end. We launched, the minister launched this program that was in April this year. As of now, it's being rolled out. And then I know the plan by the PCTA as well as Microsoft was to ensure that this is rolled out up until December. But then we know that there are some challenges, but we're impressed to see the numbers of 1,996 of learners already in the program and 457 learners who have completed and 22 learners enrolled and completed a technical certification. But all what we need to do is to sit down with the colleagues running that program so that we can assist where there are challenges, and DDG CASA will also just come in and say something. Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, DG, I will now make a request to some of my DDGs to make some comments, especially in Tibet, as well as DDG CASA. I know there was an important question that was asked by that was asked with regard to the question of recognition of prior learning, and that question, my colleague at the university branch will also just say some things or some few words, and colleagues might spend less than 10 minutes if we can so allow. Honorable Chairperson, honorable members, as well as DG, thanks very much. DG Sesung, we can come in.
Thanks, honorable Chair, and thanks, DG, and also DDG Mbalo, for the opportunity. I'm also greet all the honorable members. I think it's just only a few things that perhaps you could not touch on. I will start with the questions that were raised by the Honorable Chair, Honorable Mkhatshwa, on the pre-learning program, whether it's just a matter of semantics, is it the same as the bridging course? And the answer, Honorable Mkhatshwa, is that yes. I think there were some political issues around that, and it has to be renamed as a pre-learning program. But it is similar type of a program in relation to it being a bridging course for the students that are not ready to enter the TVET system. You also touched on the issue of the increasing entrepreneurial opportunities for TVET students. I think it's not the first time that we are touching on this one. Yes, we are on the process of expanding on the entrepreneurial hubs. Initially, we had a target of 5 that we're going to pilot, but we, on those 5, I think 3 are already there existing in some of the institutions. But we are hoping that this number could increase as we go forward. You've also touched on the issue of having a sustainable way in terms of the funding for the TVET infrastructure. It's an important point, Honorable Chair, because we cannot continue relying on NSF. We should be looking at other ways of funding that process. But at the moment, that's our only alternative that we have at this point in time. Moving on to the next question that was asked by Honorable Messier in relation to the procurement of laptops for TVET lecturers. I wish to report, Honorable Chair members, that up to so far, as a department, we have developed a policy that will be guiding us in terms of rolling out that project. But what has happened concurrent to that is that over 60% of the colleges, which means 30 out of 50 colleges, have already started supplying the laptops to their lecturers. That will include both the post-level ones, which are at entry level, as well as post-level 2, which are senior lecturers. So about 60% of the colleges have already distributed or procured these laptops. On our side of the department, the policy has been finalized. We are now working on the issue of the funding model for that, so that it is sustained over a long period of time. On the issue of the status of disbursements at NSFAS, I would kind of request, Chair, that we do submit a final report, because I think the last that we have is probably outdated, as it was done around June, and there has been some disbursement that has happened lately, so we probably request that NSFAS furnish us with the latest detailed report that you can then send to the committee. The other question that was raised by Honorable Yabo in terms of the unemployed cohort, and there was mention of electricians, I think DDG Mvalo did touch on that a bit. And I will just add, Honorable Chair and members, that one of the issues which, although there's not a study that has been done around this, is that the entry and middle-level skills at the moment, it seems to be flooded also by foreign people that are occupying such space. Because there is no proper regulation, you might find that at a construction site, instead of finding qualified electricians that are South Africans or qualified plumbers, you might find that the construction companies in the built industry, they will probably opt for what I would term as cheap labor in a way. And therefore, that then occupies the space that should have been ordinarily occupied by our own qualified people. But it also goes, Honorable Chair, to the issue of work placement, because you will find there's a contractor that has been awarded a big tender to construct a building of government, but there's no clause that says how many of the TVET or university graduates are placed on that project, and I think it is something that is perhaps needs to be regulated so that we can be able to control this. I will also make an typical example in the hospitality industry, for instance, Honorable Chair, if you go around, be it in Cape Town, Joburg, Durban, you'll find that in our restaurants, the people that are serving us with food might not necessarily be students that have done hospitality programs in TVETs, but might be of foreign nature. So those are some of the things that perhaps Honorable Chair members, we probably need to look at as to how do we ensure that we create more space for our own rather than giving it to people that are from outside, just because they are probably providing what I would call as cheap labor. Forgetting that our government has made provision through the CETA skills levy for employers that they can tap into that 1%, and these students that come from TVET, they come there with stipends. So instead of paying salary as the employer, you'll probably benefit by giving these students the stipends which the CETAs are able to afford. I think the other one was raised by Honorable Machesi. I think the DG did touch on that one around the issue of transport, but the DG touched on the issue of policy that is still is the responsibility of the Department of Transport. But I'll just indicate, Honorable Chair, that on the skills side, the TVET colleges do offer a program which is an NCV program on transport and logistics in partnership with the Department of Transport. And I think it is one of the successful programs on NCV, and it is assisting a lot in terms of giving our young people opportunities, either they go and start their own businesses in this particular area or they do find employment. But it's one of the successful programs under the NCV. I think lastly, Honorable Chair, is the question that was raised by Honorable Mahlatsi, and it's around the issue of the targets, the plan versus the enrolled. I would probably kind of request that we do submit the detailed report that talks to those targets that we can then forward to the committee. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honorable Members and DG.
DG and Honorable Chairperson, if so allowed, can I request DG Gasa? She should be the last one to comment, and then she'll also deal with the area of recognition of prior learning.
Thank you very much, DG. Good afternoon, Chairperson, Honorable Members,
And thank you very much, Titi Chimvalo. I'll try to be very brief in the interest of time. I will respond to issues pertaining to infrastructure, RPL, and to GBV, and Titi Chimvalo will indicate if there are certain questions that I have not addressed. Thank you very much. The first question that I would like to respond to is the question that was raised regarding data and the affordability thereof. I'll be very brief with this one, Chairperson. Last year when we were hit by COVID, as we indicated to the portfolio committee, we understood that for the PSAT system going forward, the strategy was never one that could take a context. Apologies for that. The strategy going forward was never one that only took concept learning going forward, but that we needed to recognize that for the PSAT system to be sustainable, we needed to look at very critically saving the academic year and saving lives. And so in many ways, as part of our infrastructure strategy, we took a holistic view, and as we indicated last year, we reprioritized our strategy. We also looked at our budgets, and as we indicated to the portfolio committee last year, the minister set up a ministerial technical task team that I was responsible for in collaboration with some of my colleagues and also the Ministry for Digital Technologies and Communications. And as part of that, we engaged mobile network operators, and as the minister indicated in his engagements with the public last year, we were able to enter into an arrangement where it was very critical for us to ensure that data costs were accessible to all students, and the agreement we came upon, which had a particular time frame, was one where we agreed on a package that cost 65 rands for 30 gigs, and that was very critical for us to ensure that we saved the academic year and we also saved lives. There was also a question that was raised about the difficulty for certain universities around bulk infrastructure, and there was specific mention made regarding issues pertaining to water and sanitation. Apologies for this, Chairperson. I will just make specific reference to the one university, although at a later stage we are available as DHEC to come and table our initiatives around infrastructure coordination and the work we do with both universities and TVET colleges, as my colleague, colleagues DDG Mvalo and DDG Zungu have just indicated. Just as an example, a few months ago, as you might be aware, we went to the University of Fort Hare and as part of announcing work that we are doing there with a range of stakeholders in terms of student accommodation. But part of the work that we do there, also linked to the district development model, was realizing that actually for some universities, especially universities like Fort Hare, we walk in there as DHEC, and we realize that actually the work of a university is relatively complex. It's not necessarily about providing teaching and learning, but it's also finding out that actually a university serves as an academic institution that plays a role in the provision of water and sanitation infrastructure. So in his capacity as both as the Minister for Education, but also in a political principal role and within the framework of the district development model, the minister facilitated a situation which we're trying to emulate in some of the work that we do, where we engage, or we were part of engaging the municipality together with the university about various innovative ways in which we could address some of the challenges that were arising as part of the university playing this dual role. Moving along, there was also then an issue that was raised which we could not agree with a chairperson about what we have been seeing in recent times. It was raised by the chairperson, and it is a huge concern for us in the sense that it is not an isolated event. The fact that in recent times we have set for ourselves as the Department of Higher Education and Training in collaboration with a range of stakeholders, key strategic priorities for what needs to be done if the PSET system must realize particular targets. But we are first realizing that there are quite significant challenges, including gender-based violence and femicide, mental health challenges that emanate or manifest as suicide, and issues around inequalities, poverty, and unemployment that manifest, for example, as some of the challenges that I was referring to when I spoke about the data challenges, that results in a huge range of a number of students not realizing some of the challenges that they have set for themselves. A number of incidents have found expression in recent times that we as the PISA system, in particular the department, are concerned about, and we appreciate the opportunity to come, for example, on the 8th of September to speak to the portfolio committee about the policy framework, a range of initiatives that we have set in space, specifically around the gender-based framework and femicide, because we recognize that incidents such as what recently happened in Fort Hare are actually not isolated, but are finding expression throughout the country. The last point that I would like to speak to is that recently as DHET, we hosted a huge engagement session that had about 165 stakeholders who met with us to reflect on the recognition of prior learning framework as part of the work that we brought here last year. Chairperson, as part of the articulation policy work, but also the national qualitative framework, and some of the key questions that arose as part of that were the extent to which is the PISA system needed to be engaged by a whole range of stakeholders about whether we were making strides in terms of addressing the trajectory that had been set beforehand, and the extent to which the PISA system could help realize and also acknowledge that there were certain gaps that were still not being met. We are able, should the portfolio committee require that, to provide a brief report in terms of some of the key messaging that came through from that. We hosted that in collaboration with some of our quality councils. Thank you very much, Didi Jimvalo. I trust that I have managed to address some of the questions that you had asked me to respond to. Thank you very much to the Portfolio Committee and to yourself, SDG.
Thanks very much, DTG Gasa and DTG Zungu. DT, can I take it back to you and the Honorable Chairperson? Thanks very much for dealing with this opportunity.
Thanks. I'll hand over to the Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, colleagues and Honorable Members. This was indeed a very fruitful engagement, and I think the interest from members indicates our collective aspirations for the economic reconstruction and recovery plan to come to fruition. I think one of the key highlights from the discussions that we've had is firstly that we need to have follow-up engagements on a myriad of the matters that were raised, particularly on the matters that DG Scott has spoke to, and how we could set up follow-up presentations on those matters. And I think that can, you know, should be a matter that's taken up to the management committee of the committee, of the portfolio committee, in relation to, for example, matters around hydrogen, the microgrid. That could be a presentation on its own. Definitely, DG, when we look at the SKA and the issues around the farmers in that area, let's perhaps package it for the visit. But there's also an opportunity for us to package it. I think just before we go into the BRRR process, there's another briefing we're receiving by the DSI on ASAF, and but yeah, maybe it'll be better for us to just take it to our oversight visit with the SKA. So that we can agree on here immediately. And then, of course, you've also indicated intention to speak to the space programs that Honorable Yabo, by and large, DG, you've also, hey, you have two, my DG, Nyambela, and I think we truly appreciate the proactiveness from your side, but I think the follow-up engagement as well with regards to how we can have a coordinated form of budgeting across departments in relation to also, earmarking certain budget allocations for programs of the department or science and innovation programs that should not only exist within the Department of Science and Innovation but across departments. And I think that sort of conversation is vital, and I know you'd like to make presentations on that, even on the progress on the decadal plan as well. Or the progress that you've made with regards to the decadal plan, and coming out of your consultation within government itself and various government departments, and how you intend in then expanding that consultative process to external members outside of government. So we've noted, DG, areas where you have indicated your intent or wishes to want to present more thoroughly to the committee, and we will find ways of integrating that into the program of the committee. Again, coming out of the deliberations this afternoon is the fact that funding remains, the lack thereof, remains a massive constraint to some of the really great sort of programs that have been outlined by both DHET and DSI. And I think what's also very key that's come out is, how do we cost these great ideas that have come out, and also how do we bring back to what you've been saying, BG, how do we have a coordinated budgeting amongst government departments and other stakeholders outside of the public sector to try and bring these plans to fruition, or these programs to fruition. I think another matter that came up is that even though we're saying that these programs are existing programs that would then form part and parcel of the economic reconstruction and recovery plan, I guess this moment also just calls for us to reflect and introspect on these programs and the fact that maybe some of them should have long been standing, and we should be way more ahead in terms of having to have achieved them. I'll continue to find ways of saying that in a way that's more clearer. But the question that is also coming up is we should be much more further with some of these programs than we are at this point in time. There's a great sentiment around the importance for consultation across various stakeholders and interdepartmental consultation and planning as well, and that I think also has come up a lot with the fact that DG referred to certain programs that are fall within a specific line department, and so I think that continued sort of
interdepartmental planning and coordination is vital, noting the many issues that members raise across various departments, transport, agriculture, minerals, energy. So a lot of work needs to be done with regards to that. A further sort of analysis needs to be made with regards to the demand for certain skills, the skills that are then offered because of that demand, and the placement of those skills, or the placement of the individuals who have now acquired those skills. And that sort of an understanding the relationship there is something that remains of concern, because when we look at the data, it doesn't correlate. There's a huge concern with going back to funding on the fact that we, you know, we need to be very critical of the state of our entities as we implore on them to fulfill certain programs as part and parcel of the economic reconstruction and recovery plan, and to make sure that our entities, in terms of, you know, their status with the Auditor General, is on par before we even, you know, consider redirecting certain funds in order for some certain programs that are existing within some of these entities to then find fruition in the plans of the ERRP. I think also, again, then just, you know, recognizing a few issues would then be, of course, I think I was mentioned clarifying, you know, the various roles of different departments in the promotion of the ERRP and what everyone's roles are. With regards to the green economy and green initiatives, green youth initiatives, that question wasn't answered clearly, but I'd like for it to be responded to in writing. So we note that, you know, the linear versus circular economy has been clarified, and the green economy has also been clarified, but what exactly are the initiatives that are being rolled out there, and how many young people are benefiting from that? That was the exact question. If that can be responded to in writing, we'd appreciate that. Honourable members, there are many matters that have come up in the discussion that we had this afternoon, and it's very clear that the ERRP is really pivotal to us trying to come out of this COVID-19 pandemic as a government, as a country, and it needs funding, it needs the buy-in of stakeholders, both private and compact. It needs us to be efficient in how we manage and govern state resources and what we have. It needs us to be coordinated and deliberate and to really be on our toes. And there are many matters that are coming up from the conversations we've had that need us to really zoom into them and have further more elaborative conversations around that. Having said that, Honourable Member, thank you so much for your time. We are supposed to be adopting minutes. I don't know if members are okay. I don't know if we need quorum. If we can just check Shanaz. It's myself, Yabo, who are still on the platform, Honorable Koza, that's three. Honorable Litsie, that's four. Honorable Boshoff is still here. Honorable Makesi, six. I would then believe, Honorable Joko, seven. I then believe, Shanaz, that we are able to adopt the minutes. Can I just have an indication from yourself? Honorable Koza? Honorable Mananiso?
Okay, thank you, Chair. I herewith want to adopt the minutes of the 17 as a true reflection. I'm not sure we are adopting them one by one, or I can do that collectively.
I just wanted to check with the Secretariat that I am in order by saying that we can adopt the minutes and that we are meeting quorum.
Okay.
Thank you, okay. All right. Thank you very much. So, Honorable Manisa, you are coming forth for the adoption of the minutes on the 17th.
Yes, I adopt the minutes as a true reflection of the meeting. Thank you.
Okay, I just want to confirm with members what the minutes of the 17th are, so for record purposes.
So on the 17th of August, we would have set for the oversight inquiry into the appointment of Prof. Mbati as Vice Chancellor of Sefako Mohato and other related matters. Honorable Mananiso has indicated that her intention to adopt the minutes. Can I note someone to second those minutes? Honorable Sibiya.
I'm supporting the adopted minutes by Honorable Mananiso.
Thank you, Honorable Sibiya. On the 18th, the inquiry continued. Can I note hands to adopt? Honorable Mananiso?
Thank you, Chair. I would like to adopt the minutes as a third question as well of the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mananiso. Honorable Lipie?
Supported, Chair.
Thank you.
I'm just moving the seconding of the adoption of those minutes.
And then the last one then would be the briefing by the Department of Science and Innovation and Higher Education and Training on the fourth quarter 2020-2021 and the first quarter 2021-2022 on those performance reports. So hands to adopt, please. Honorable Lizier.
Yes, we're moving for the adoption.
A hand to second the adoption, please. Honorable Mananiso?
Yes, Chair.
Thank you. I move for the adoption of the minutes. Actually, I'm seconding the minutes as adopted for the first question. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mananiso. I'm sorry to the department for pulling you to stay through our process of adopting the minutes. I should have released you. And I apologize on that, DG and Ms. Dambalo and colleagues from that side, but they were very quick. Having said that, honorable members and colleagues, this meeting has come to an end. Thank you so much for your time.
Recording stopped.
Thank you so much. Take care.